Tonight on The Download, former SNL cast member Julia Sweeney, author of Craft Coffee Emmanuel, Jessica Isto, and artist and scientist Hunter Cole. Now, here's your host, a man who went to coffee college but was too tired to finish, Justin Kaufman.
There's some truth to that. I am a college coffee graduate. Coffee college graduate, right? When I was a barista, back in the day when I was a barista, when it was cool to be a barista. When I was in college, I was working at an independent coffee shop, Transitions Book Place, which was a personal growth bookstore. That four-hour show is coming up soon. And I worked in the coffee shop side. There's a lot of fun and a lot of great people. Still stay in contact with some people there. That place is no longer, don't look for it, it's not there anymore. It's now an Epic Burger and an Ulta and a shoe, something like that. Anyway, I then had to get a job at Starbucks. And there was one by my house and I got the job. And they make you, when you were, maybe they still do this, but they make you go to coffee college. You go to the nondescript place at Clark and Division where there was a Starbucks headquarters, and you go in, and for the day you learn how to hit a button on a timer for how long an espresso shot's supposed to be and how to actually do the call, grande, mocha, joca, all that kind of stuff. And I hated it. I resented it. I thought I was a class clown even in that. I just didn't like, because I already had experience. I know how to do it. I was trained by somebody at the Transitions who had come from the Starbucks, so I knew it, but they didn't buy it.
I also worked at Starbucks and did not have to go through any of that. I had to, had to read a manual, perhaps, to maybe learn some things. But
you millennials.
Yeah, right. And I was a horrible employee.
I was horrible, too. The college didn't mean anything.
So, I mean, I should have. They should have sent me to college.
I wasn't horrible. I entered into a store at the time. This was mid-90s, right? Where they had awesome Starbucks culture there. And I hated that. I mean, this the idea that you would go into a store and no one, they brag that no one ever left that, so no one ever quit, no one ever got fired because they just all loved each other. And then, the person they loved the most had to leave. And so I was the replacement.
Oh, no.
And they're like, this is how Rick used to do it. And I'm like, okay, well, I'm not Rick. And it was constant for the length of 6 months that I worked there, whatever, where it was, they treated me like I didn't understand what I was doing. And to their credit, they were right. I didn't understand what I was doing. But I remember, the only thing I remember from that job was going home smelling like Starbucks.
Yeah.
And if you made the mistake, because you get in that 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the morning where people line up.
Yeah,
But if you made the mistake of crashing, like on your bed, like you were just like so tired and just crashed, and you didn't take a shower, you were
forget about
you had
it.
To go find a laundromat for the next day because it smelled like coffee for the rest of the night week.
I started during the summer, so you had all the crazy winter the cold drinks, the frappuccinos stuff.
Right.
Oh man, And I could never figure out how many pumps the large gets, So I'd be just pumping. I'm like, this is about right.
I will say, and being an ex Starbucks employee, I will say that to this day I will not order fancy, complicated drinks because I knew how much of a pain in the butt they were.
Yeah.
And so Frappuccinos are on that list. Even if I was like, oh, that looks so good, I'll be like, I can't do it. I can't do it to my brethren.
Yeah.
I just can't do it because the minute you say, I'll have a grande frappuccino, they go, what? Okay. You want some chocolate? And now you know why. It's a download. Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. We got a great show lined up tonight. Julie Sweeney's with us. She's at the big table. We'll talk about her new workshop. Putting together some new material for a one-woman show. She's workshopping it at Second City through March. We'll talk to her about her life on stage at Second City, but not as much about that. I want to talk to her about life after SNL, because when she was at SNL, she played characters. She came from the Groundlings, she played characters. But Julia Sweeney, for everyone knows her from Pat and playing other characters like that, but she has had a tremendous career doing one-woman shows, especially her one-woman show that dealt with her cancer one that, I mean, these shows were, there was turned into a film. Quentin Tarantino produced it. I mean, there's a lot of career after SNL that, that really has transformed her into one of the finest storytellers in the country. And she continues to do that, even as people recognize her on the street as something from SNL or, you know, movies, things like that. That's her bread and butter. And I want to talk to her about that transition of playing characters to playing herself and providing intimate details about her life, her health, and her family on stage. Julia Sweeney, my guest at the big table. Also coming up tonight, we'll talk about reimagining HR in 2018 and downloading Chicago Business. We'll talk about craft coffee with Jessica Isto and bacteria. Art. Art and science converge. New Hunter Cole's got a new exhibit in Bucktown at an art gallery where not only is bacteria drawn and part of the paintings and the art and the multimedia presentation that's at the gallery, but it's also part of the process of making the art. Wow, I'm so excited about that. And we'll play the worst. Hassan Ali and Claire Zelke here tonight. We got a wonderful show lined up. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by my man Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll do a carry out, so stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN, so let's carry out. Here are today's top stories. We're really doubling down on racism as a focal point of politics these days. Of course, President Trump told us he's the least racist person the press has ever interviewed. And now Governor Rauner is being condemned for not calling Trump and KKK Grand Wizard David Duke racists on a radio interview. First off, what was the question? Is David Duke a racist? Governor Rauner, your thoughts? Why are you asking the governor of Illinois that question? And why isn't the answer the KKK guy? Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure he's a racist and he's okay with me saying that, right? I mean, I get it. Keep all your voting options open, Governor, but it seems a bit too PC to not call it out. The governor's office came out with a nicely coiffed statement condemning David Duke afterwards, but okay. All right. On the other side of the aisle, the three top gubernatorial candidates all admitted to smoking pot in their past. Again, what was the question? Wow, David Duke, marijuana confessions, trickle-down economics. We just can't get away from the 80s, can we? What's next? Bill Cosby's going to get another sitcom? Oh, I wouldn't be surprised. A judge ordered the state of Illinois to expand the categories of ailments that would be eligible for medical marijuana. God, you know what? This story makes me so anxious. Doesn't it make you anxious, Pete? I'm anxious. I feel like I have anxiety. I need to go to the doctor's office behind the dispensary and see what can be done about this. Also, I have phantom hair pain. Yeah, I don't know if that's one of the categories, but phantom hair pain. There was a Judiciary Committee today to talk immigration and plans for the wall. I'm more of a Dark Side of the Moon guy, but whatever. So this was supposed to be a serious meeting about serious issues and devolved into a meeting about who heard what, when, and how they can't recall. Government has turned into the high school principal trying to get to the bottom of who swore at the driver from the back of the bus. No one leaves till we find out who said it. It's like the Breakfast Club. Who shut that door? No. So? One more, Bender. Stop. Yeah, that was me doing Breakfast Club theater. The director of Homeland Security was in that immigration meeting that touched off this naughty language firestorm. And she says she didn't hear the words in question, but the president did use tough language. Tough language? That's what we're calling it now? If maybe the senator from Illinois heard the president wrong, I'll give him that. But the tone still implies that this wasn't tough, probably more rough, right? I know we're splitting consonants here, but, I mean, they do mean two different things, right? Rough and tough? I don't know. And what was the response from the White House? Well, they say since there's no movement on immigration, they're just going to ask their Supreme Court to allow them to kill DACA, which could lead to deportations for kids born in America to undocumented immigrants. Which would be a really crappy move by the American government, since DACA required kids to come forward and sign up for those protections. So now the government has their names and locations. You can't get more evil than that, right? I know there are people very gung-ho on cracking down on immigration. I understand that. But even you could see how the government double-crossing on DACA is lame as all get out, right? No? We're staying partisan on this one? No? That's pretty evil. Even by evil standards. Speaking of evil, Steve Bannon was subpoenaed. Yeah, you know what? Pass. I don't care about that dude. Quick update on the president's scandal over allegedly giving hush money to a porn star to cover up an extramarital affair. The update is that it's still not a scandal. How about that? You know, all that means is that the country is really tired. Yeah. Hey, Chicago, here's some news, some positive news. Tourism hit 55 million visitors in 2017. That is a brand new record. And all the tourists went home and were like, man, that Nutella store was amazing. Chocolate that you spread? Chicago's great. They make chocolate that spreads. In weather, more winter. Going to be mid-40s this weekend, though, so tough it out. Actually, it's negative 88 degrees in some parts of Russia today. Negative 88. Yeah. What do you do? I mean, that double the gloves? You got wool socks? Two wool socks? I don't even know what you do at that point. I feel like they probably got a a ratio thing. It's like nine pairs of wool socks. In sports, after yesterday's win, the Bulls have now won three in a row. They're starting to click at the right time, and even though they're 10 games under 500, the team is only six games out for the eighth spot in the East. Now, usually, you'd say, only six games. You, sir, are an idiot. But this team started 3-17, remember that? And since that awful start, thanks, Bobby Portis, the team has gone 14-10, which is respectable. And that's not bad. Think about it. There's not a bona fide all-star on this team. Tomorrow, Golden State comes to the UC. Let's truly see where the young Bulls are right now. Kevin Durant, Steph Curry, and the Golden State Warriors tomorrow night. In college basketball, the Illini got a four-point play with less than 10 seconds last night. It looked like they were going to upset Nebraska, till Nebraska easily strided down the court and hit a three to win it. The Illini are 0-6 in the Big Ten. Yikes. Northwestern plays tomorrow night against number 22, Ohio State. They got blown out at Indiana over the weekend and find themselves needing a winning streak just to get to the bubble. Come on, guys. Let's start now. Can you believe it's less than a month till pitchers and catchers report to spring training? The Cubs convention's already come and gone. And no Jake Arrieta. Missed a nice drama moment to introduce him, but no go. The only thing I learned from the convention is that Sammy Sosa has to fess up of being all roided up before he can come back, and that Chili Davis is still the best name in 80s baseball. Back to Sosa. Seriously, the Cubs management is going to go get all holier than thou and force a player to admit he was once on the juice before he can come back and sit in the suites and eat free hot dogs? That has to sting. God, I hope that Sosa wasn't juicing, you know? And that he's exonerated and then the Ricketts have to apologize themselves. That would be better. I still don't get how the Cubs are somehow off the hook in this whole equation. I remember going to those Cub games and they seem to really like selling those Sosa jerseys. Not sure how much Sosa got a cut. So they can make money off of him, but now they forgot about that? That's a hot take. It's a 20-year-old hot take, but I'm really getting good at this hot take stuff. Warm take with Justin Kaufman. This weekend, football, the Jags versus the Patriots, Brady, Belichick, Bortles, Foles, Keenum. I'm up. What happened? Is it the NBA All-Star game yet? The Bears are getting nasty grades, dare I say, failing for their 2017 free agent class. Mike Glennon, Marcus Wheaton, Marcus Cooper. Oof. Glennon was one of the worst QBs in the NFL. Wheaton caught three balls all year long, and Marcus Cooper dropped the ball short of the end zone after running back a blocked field goal. Wow, that's bad. Bad enough for a GM to get a contract extension, apparently. So there you go. And finally, a group in California is lobbying to create a 51st state called New California. This would be all of the western, more or eastern, more rural parts of the state, leaving the more urban coastline areas alone. They want to start a new state because the old state is ungovernable due to high taxes, corruption, and monoparty politics. It just goes to show you, Illinois, even in paradise, people want to move to Indiana. Although I wonder who gets to keep the raisins. Something to think about. That's the carry out for January 16, 2018. We're working hard to make sure we have enough hot cocoa available for all you shovelers out there. So I'll be blunt. Our hot chocolate is less hot chocolate, more hot dusted water. All right, coming up, the download on Chicago Business. Talk about reimagining the HR department. How they can help market and publicize the right hire. That's what we're talking about coming up here on Download on Chicago Business. So stay with us.
It's business time. It's business. It's business time.
I know what you're trying to say. You're trying to say it's time for business. It's business time.
Ooh, it's business.
It's time for the Download in Chicago Business, sponsored by Signature Bank. This is our weekly segment that features CEOs and entrepreneurs sharing their stories so we can better understand ours. Last week, we talked with the CEO of Culture Studio, talking about their booming apparel business. Before that, we talked with former Chicago Bear Israel Adonijay about teaching kids to code. Those conversations and more can be found at WGNradio.com. Just search the Download on Chicago Business. We've had a lot of young entrepreneurs on the program talking about their most important asset, and that's people. And inevitably, we talk about the culture they create to keep those people motivated. Rarely do any of those conversations talk about the culture featuring a strong HR department. Human resources is more important than ever and is overlooked, especially when an entrepreneur wants to create a more casual culture in the workplace. Tonight, we talk about HR in 2018, but not just about sexual harassment and keeping employees safe and secure, but to talk about the role of HR and how it's shifting from just personnel, but to other functions like marketing and PR and trying to find the best employees possible for the business. More often than not, it's the HR department's job to create the culture so many entrepreneurs are striving for. And are professionals in that area prepared for that duty? Adam Robinson is the CEO and co-founder of Hireology, a talent recruitment firm for independently owned businesses. They serve over 3,700 businesses across several industries. He's also the author of The Best Team Wins, Build Your Business Through Predictive Hiring. And Hireology was named by Inc. Magazine as one of the best places to work. Currently, the company has over 130 employees. Adam Robinson, welcome to the Download.
Thanks for having me here. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, this is a fascinating area because I have so many different CEOs, entrepreneurs, people in hot business. People come in who are just like, oh, you know, culture, people. Most important thing is people. I want to do this my way, this way. And rarely does the word HR, human resources, come up. And when you think about the idea of the HR department having an integral role in hiring, it should.
It should. People think process is important when they build their business, and so they have process around everything, sales and marketing, customer relationships, support, finance, and they build their business around these processes, and then they'll stand and say, people are our most important asset. And when you ask the entrepreneur or CEO, well, what processes do you have in place to make sure you do that predictably every single time? There really isn't any. I mean, most companies have no predictable.
Do they just do it by gut? I mean, what do they do?
You know, we think we're better at this than we really are. Hmm. I mean, studies show, in fact, that we are better at looking at a resume and having no other input. Our decision is better than if we sit in front of that person and wing it in an interview. Our ability to pick the right person actually decreases when we have unstructured interaction with people. That's what the research says, because we're wired to have certain biases, mm-hmm. and hire people like us and all these other things that happen that override what you really try to predict is this person qualified and able to perform in this job? Human beings are really bad at doing that, as it turns out. And so process is critical. And it is the role of HR to bring that forward. And I think it's the real differentiator for tomorrow's leaders.
Far too often, companies or small businesses will do it by gut, or they hire out to talent recruiters or to executive searches and have somebody else kind of bring it in, and then they make the choice. How important is it to have an HR department that's in-house, that's part of the hiring, that understands the hiring philosophy that you're trying to execute with your business?
Well, my answer to that question is a question to business leaders considering whether or not to make this a core and critical part of their business. Would you rather have first crack at the best talent in your industry, or do you want to be relegated to hiring the people your biggest competitor determined were not good enough to work for them? That is the reality of the job market we're in. You can hire the best, or you can hire what's remaining after someone better than you at doing this got first crack. And think of the competitive advantage that then accrues to the leader or the business that does this best. Branding the opportunity, yeah. Bringing the right people in, building the great culture, all of these things are real strategic weapons in highly competitive markets. And if you're just throwing it to a search firm or posting and praying online, your result's going to be worse. You're operating at such a disadvantage. It is really going to harm you over the long run.
Adam, what is predictive hiring? I mean, that's a big part of your book and what you wrote about. But I'm fascinated on the concept of predictive hiring.
We teach our customers to think about hiring like car insurance. So State Farm doesn't need to meet you to know that if you have a 16-year-old driver in your family and a sports car in the garage and your spouse has had five accidents, that you're probably going to cost them some money at some point. And maybe not you individually, but people like you with your risk profile tend to be really expensive customers. What they never do is take one look at you and say, you know what, man, you look like a pretty good driver.
Good luck out there, buddy. I like your style.
Let's sign him up. Let's see how that works out. It would be a horrible mistake.
Right, that would be terrible.
They know, they ask five or six things, and they have a pretty good understanding of the risk profile. Why do FICO scores work? FICO scores work because, as it turns out, your borrowing level relative to your income and whether or not you've paid your bills in the past is highly predictive of your propensity to do that in the future. Why is Moneyball famous? Well, it turns out that if you're trying to predict player value, there's a couple of things you look at, and it's highly predictive. Well, the same thing happens in hiring. Same math, same underwriting process. And it doesn't have to be complicated. If you know what outcomes you're trying to achieve in a role, which is not a job description, right? That's not make cold calls. It's set five meetings a week is the difference. If I know I'm looking to hire somebody that can set five appointments a week, I can look to things that predict whether or not those outcomes are going to happen. And then once I'm asking those things and determining those things consistently and repeatedly, I can underwrite that risk. And if I can dial my risk profile down, I'll be right more than I'm wrong. Most businesses are right 4 or 5 times out of 10. Companies that use a predictive hiring process can be right 6 or 7 times out of 10. That's 50% better than your competition at your most important asset. That's pretty good.
Adam Robinson is the CEO and co-founder of Hireology. We're talking about predictive hiring and making a more efficient HR department, really, when it comes to hiring. Let's talk more about that. First, we'll take a break and we'll come back and we'll continue the download on Chicago Business. Stay with us.
It's business time.
Download on Chicago Business, sponsored by Signature Bank. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest tonight in studio, Adam Robinson, is the CEO and co-founder of Hireology, a talent recruitment firm for independently owned businesses. They serve over 3,700 businesses across several industries. He's also the author of The Best Team Wins, Build Your Business Through Predictive Hiring, talking about HR departments, predictive hiring, and how they can HR departments can better serve the brand that is the business by using tools like predictive hiring. I guess the question I have, and the one that I think a lot of people might have, is are HR professionals, whether they're coming up through college or being trained in some way in workshops, other, are they prepared for all of the things that are being put on their plate? It used to be, what, they had a couple of things they had to do to sign the paycheck or cut the paycheck. But now there's this, there's making sure they've got the right job descriptions, interviews, not to mention misconduct and monitoring and policing the office.
Yeah, the traditional role of HR has been administrative, but recruiting is a sales function, right? You are convincing someone to leave their job where they're theoretically successful because you're looking to bring the best into your company. You're trying to convince them to leave. That involves a transfer of trust. That doesn't happen with an online application and an automated process. That happens when human beings talk to each other and have a constructive conversation. And so traditional HR is to human capital strategy what accounting is to the finance department. It's really important, but that's not the whole story. HR can be strategic, managing the employment brand, be the keepers of the culture. And when those things are happening, all the other administrative things and compliance related issues and, you know, the things that are you hear about in, you know, in the news today around harassment policies and diversity and hiring, all these other things, those things start to take care of themselves when leadership at the top demands that it be a priority. And so great human capital practices start with the CEO of
right.
the business.
Are HR professionals being trained this way? I mean, when we talk about predictive hiring and other places like that, I mean, are you seeing more employees coming out of college to do this kind of thing?
Certainly not out of college. Leading companies are making the investment in teaching their folks how to be better at hiring and selection. But it is the last untapped ROI for most businesses. I mean, when we looked at research that showed 84% of seasoned HR professionals fail basic qualifications for hiring and selection. Everyone's making it up. Managers are busy. HR is busy. Everyone thinks it's just having a conversation and hiring the people we like, flip a coin, hope they work out. I mean, that's hiring at most companies, right? It's, oh, did you like them? I liked them. Did you like them? Yeah, yes, I liked them, right? Let's hope that works. That's a coin flip. We could save everyone time, hire everybody that comes up tails, call it a day. You'll be right half the time. I mean, let's just move on. You can be better than a coin flip. But there, you learn this on the job. You don't learn this in college.
Yeah. I mean, do you see, I mean, especially in your work and at Hirology, a need for more training, more workshops, more education for professionals to come into this kind of job?
Absolutely. I think HR professionals who want to be strategic will make putting the right person in the right seat, if we could call it that, that skill set, right person, right seat, that is a game changer for most businesses. To be able to predictably and repeatably do that at scale over time is such a competitive advantage. HR professionals who get really good at that and teaching their managers how to get really good at that, that's job for life kind of stuff. I mean, that is such a value to the business.
You know, I love that Hirology is your company, is your CEO of the company. I mean, a lot of what we're talking about is getting CEOs to understand that HR has to be different. I mean, in your situation as a CEO of a company that is essentially an HR company, do you have to do the same thing? Do you have to be reminded of that? Do you have to? How do you set up your HR department and make sure that it's in line with what you're talking
about? Well, absolutely. Well, so if we didn't use our own software, I'd be a hypocrite, right? So we follow our own process. We do this internally. There is a process. It is scored and measured. It's reported to the company every week. Are we following the process? Are we doing it fast enough? Are the results solid? We look at that all the time. And so we hold ourselves accountable to that. I still interview every candidate that comes through as a final interview to find out how their experience has been with us, to see if there are any concerns or questions that they have about the role, mm-hmm. and then just to talk about whatever's on their mind. Is there a question you want to ask that you haven't felt comfortable asking? Because now's the time. I mean, I want them to walk away and have a meaningful conversation with their significant other, and the end of that conversation is either going to be, you know what, it just doesn't feel right, or it's going to be, you know what, I cannot wait to join this company. And if you do it right, if we do it right, the wrong fits fire themselves before we make the offer. We give them enough information. I was talking earlier today with someone about this. We're not selling. We're getting them to buy. It's very different. I'm not pitching you on how great we are. I'm giving you the information that you can use to determine whether or not this is right for you. Hmm. And if you determine it's right for you, you own that decision.
There's some ego involved with that. I mean, I would assume that you want to sell your wares and say this is a great company and you should be happy to work for this company. So there is a little putting your ego in check to say, I have to think of it the other way.
Yeah, absolutely. As great as we might think we are, convincing someone to work for us is not the way to do it. The mentality is not, here's what we're looking for, come on and apply. The mentality is, our hiring process is really strict. It's really hard to get a job here. But if you do, you join a team of people that is going to be the best team you've ever worked with. I mean, just, I wish more people had that mentality.
Adam Robinson is the CEO and co-founder of Hirology, a talent recruitment firm for independently owned businesses. He's also the author of The Best Team Wins, Build Your Business Through Predictive Hiring. Adam, my guest tonight at the Download in Chicago Business. A pleasure talking to you, and thanks. And I'd love to have you back to continue the conversation about great human resources.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.
Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is back on stage in Chicago with her new stand-up showcase / workshop. It's called Julia Sweeney, Older and Wider. It runs through March 18th at Judy's Beat Lounge at Second City. Julia Sweeney's no stranger to the stage. She, of course, was a cast member on Saturday Night Live, but she also created hit one-woman shows and monologues. Her show God Says Ha was a personal one about her and her brother's battle with cancer. That show went from a monologue to a one-woman show to an award-winning film produced by Quentin Tarantino to a memoir. She's also tackled other personal subjects like religion and faith in her show Letting Go of God. Those shows, plus others, have helped redefine Julia Sweeney as one of America's finest storytellers. Sweeney has starred in television and films. She lives right here in the Chicago area, and she is my guest at the big table tonight. Julia Sweeney, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
You have gone out of the way to make sure that I refer to this as workshop.
Yes.
Why is that important to you, to let the audience know
that
it's a workshop?
Because it's not really a finished show yet. I'm doing 14 shows there to kind of figure out what the show is. And some people really like watching the process, like, or how the sausage is made or whatever, but it's really me and a legal pad, and I have like 10 stories, and some of them are going to fall flat and some of them are going to work, I hope. And then over the course of these 14 shows, I'll sort of shape it into whatever it's going to be.
Is that the process that you've worked with the other
yeah.
shows? Is that something you learned from those shows, or is that how you set out to do those shows in the first place?
Well, the first time I did it, it was sort of by accident. I was just performing at a club on Sunday nights during this terrible year where I had cancer and my brother had cancer. And every week I would just get up on stage and vent about what happened, you know, that week. I didn't even have notes. I just got up and talked about like how it drove me crazy how my mother punched the elevator button or
right.
something like that. Like I just vented. And then at the end of the year, after everything had happened, my brother died, I got beyond my own cancer. And then I was thinking I have to go back to work. So I thought, well, I'll just put together maybe a few stories to kind of show casting directors. But it turned out the guy who produced the show at this club had recorded all my stuff.
Yeah.
And then that's how it got to This American Life. And so then I had all these recordings, which I didn't even know he was recording it. And I forgot so much. I mean, like, you know, it's like you forget all the details. But then I had everything.
Yeah.
So that one was different. So I was able to kind of craft it from all these tapes.
Listening, because today I went and listened to some of those early This American Lives where you could hear you telling the stories, that the Genesis stories that became God Says Ha.
Yeah.
It's so real. It doesn't sound like a show. It doesn't sound like a stand-up routine. It doesn't even sound like a monologue. You're
right.
telling the story of
right.
your life right there, and there's even points where you're reticent to tell it. Oh, should I tell this? And you're laughing through it. But there's something. It's eye-opening. It's material that you don't necessarily hear unpolished and organic
right.
like that in a good way.
Well, it's a good way for the audience. For me, it's a nightmare because it is horrible. You don't know what you should say. At that club, there's only 50 people in that club.
This is Uncabaret, which
is
famous.
Yeah, it is. It's like a tightrope walk, and it's scary. I mean, in some ways, that's what makes the workshop, in some ways, maybe the best. Because then once I shape it and I figure out the arc of it, it's more polished. And I feel like I'm a good actress, so I play it.
Right.
But it isn't like telling it the first time. And so that's kind of what these are,
right.
these shows are.
And that's what I was going to say about what you're doing at Second City. How much do you prepare? I mean, are you sitting in front of the mirror at home getting like you would for...
Well, not the mirror. I do wake up in the middle of the night with a thing.
Sorry, I don't know. I don't want to assume how you prepare. But my point being
I really just say it in my head and try to find enough stuff that I think will have enough laughs, but also is interesting enough to do. And then the other thing that I think is really hard about what I do is I really learn how to do what I do while I'm doing it. I mean, that's true in life. Like, talking makes me understand how I feel. Like, I kind of, like, need to open up, you know, some kind of muse or whatever and do it, and then that's how I figure out how it's done. Even though I know a lot of artists who really aren't that way.
Right.
They really polish it in this thing, and then they bring it out. But for me, I'm a lot messier than that.
Comics, a lot of your peers and friends and cast members and others, they're famous stories of them getting up on stage at a comedy club in
right.
LA and just riffing until they
right.
find something. There is a tradition to this
right.
style.
Yeah, yeah.
Out.
It's just, I'm so nerve-wracked about doing these shows.
Because really?
It's really, oh yeah, I am. It's terrifying. I feel like I'm going to go out there, like, I have like about 15 ideas. Like, I have two fears. One is that I get through two ideas. They're not the funny ideas and the show's over. And people have just sat there and listened to me ramble on for an hour that wasn't even funny. Or I get through everything I can think of in 10 minutes and I'm just looking at the audience. And they're looking at me, and I'm going, well, that's what I got.
Let's hope that there's a happy medium in there for what happens at Judy's Beat Lounge. It is an interesting concept and process because you have to, in a way, accept that fear because that's the point of trying to find the right material. If you knew exactly everything that was going to happen, you're not going to improve upon the material.
Right. There's all these really interesting things that happen when you're on stage. You get laughs where you don't expect it. You think of something in the moment. You know, when you stop for the audience to laugh, sometimes other things start occurring to you. There's just all kinds of messy, great stuff that can happen and terrible stuff that can happen. Things cannot work. Things you were sure would work don't work, or they seem too rote or too planned. Because that's the other thing. There's this illusion that you really are saying it for the first time. Although I have to say, in these shows, I really will be saying it for the first time.
There's there's a specialness when you listen to the tapes of This American Life and the tapes of you at the Uncabaret when you started, really started this career of almost being
a model. By accident.
Because
at
that time,
I didn't even want to be that.
I mean, I was going to ask you about that in this interview, about how much of that was a decision for the direction of your career.
No, it's completely was put upon me and now I can't escape it. First of all, I did God Said Ha, and then that was such a huge success. People were like, well, what's your next one? I go, there's no next one. That's it. I mean, I'm not going to have a big, terrible thing happen to me again, I hope. Because that one, I felt like, because it was about this horrible year with my brother
personal,
and everything.
Right.
And so I didn't have anything like that. Then I had a friend who was a producer in New York. Oh, I was adopting my daughter at the time. And I was just doing the uncap and just telling stories about that process. He goes, I think that could be a show. I'm going to bring you to New York and just make that a show. And I'm just going to put you up and you're going to get like 6 weeks in New York to just come up with the show. And then I was like, oh, God. And then I felt like I'm exploiting my daughter, my poor daughter. Not only does she have to get adopted, but then I have to do a show about her. It made me feel terrible. But then I thought, well, it'd be nice to do a show that isn't fraught with so much weight like God Said Ha was. So I did it, and it was okay. I mean, the show turned out good. But then during that same time, I was going through this big sort of philosophical searching, religious searching thing, and I realized that I didn't believe in God at all. And for me, that was this huge traumatic experience.
Catholic
and,
growing up. Yeah.
And traumatic, but also wonderful. And I thought, ooh, just intellectually, or even as a craftsperson, I would like to see if I can turn that show, this experience, into a show, which is really a drama that takes place in your head. So then I just did that one, really to see if I could do it. Almost to prove to myself I could do it. Then when I was done with that, I was so sick of talking about myself. I was like, I have done enough talking about me. The world does not need one more story from me. Okay, I have like
yet
my
the world
quota.
Wants more. They want
okay,
more.
Okay, so then I thought I'm going to write. And also I didn't want to perform anymore. And that's when I married my husband 10 years ago. He said, I can pay the bills, so I didn't have to do that. I left Hollywood with my daughter. He adopted my daughter. We created this family. And for 10 years, I've really been an at-home mom, happy to be an at-home mom, thinking I will just be a writer. And then I had a fantasy, a desire to direct. So in the last few years, I had a script. I got a cast. I almost got the money. And then that all fell apart. And then last June, when it really fell apart, I was like, damn it.
I can feel it.
And then other accidents happen. Like I started hanging out at Second City because they have the Harold Ramis Film School there. Right. And I have a couple of friends there. And so I was helping to teach the classes. And I was in 5 different short films in the summer.
I was going to say, that's the wrong place to be if you're trying to get away from the stage.
No,
right?
No, first of all, the students are incredible.
Yeah.
That program.
Yeah, of course. But
it's
just saying,
so great.
There's so much creativity happening
so
there.
Much,
yeah.
It was really fun. I loved all the students. And then I'm hanging out at Second City. And then I was like, you know, first of all, I'm 58. It's just turned out that this is what I'm good at. It's like I have to, you know, like life is sort of a lot of accidents and you just have to accept it. And so now I'm like, okay, well, my daughter's about to graduate. Like, maybe I could do this for 20 more years and, like, every few years come up with a show. Like, maybe that is
that
my
path.
Oh, that
would be awesome. Yeah.
So that's what's happened.
Julia Sweeney's blah, blah, my blah. Guest. Julia Sweeney, Older and Wider, the showcase/workshop, which is going to be at Judy's Beat Lounge at Second City. It runs through March 18th. We'll take a quick break here, and then we'll come back more with Julia Sweeney at the big table. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download Here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest in studio tonight, Julia Sweeney, longtime monologuist, actress, writer, Saturday Night Live cast member. She's got a new showcase slash workshop called Julia Sweeney, Older and Wider, runs through March 18th at Judy's Beat Lounge at Second City. You know, when I heard the fact that you were going to do this, and I said, I'd love to talk, because I was a fan of how we were able to hear the process, at least hear it,
right,
from the Uncabaret stuff that was on This American Life to what became God Said Ha. You know, it's amazing to me that you were able to take those tapes and that moment. Because when you listen to that, it's in a moment. The Uncabaret show is a...
Make it dull enough to be a show.
When you listen to it, you're like, wow, it's amazing how that doesn't sound like anything else. It doesn't sound like a stand-up. It doesn't sound like a monologue. You're really kind of, I don't know, should I tell this story? Should I not tell the story?
Right.
You know, talking about your parents and your brother and you. And how much of that intimacy can you recapture? I guess that's the question for you as an artist who someone's on stage.
I'm realizing talking to you that I will never be as good as I was then. And that's in a way true because... Yeah, that is something that just happens. I don't know if you can plan it. Yeah, the show that I'm doing now, you know, I'm telling personal stories and some really personal stories. In fact, I have one big set thing that's an incredibly personal story that I don't know if is going to work. But it's not going to have that immediacy. For one thing, I have a lot more experience.
And you're not as nervous to tell it, right?
Right. And I don't, there's less at stake. That was just a very special thing where I was in this little room and in a huge crisis in my life, and I had one outlet every week, and it was that room. So that can't happen again. But I'm glad it can't happen again, because that was a really terrible time also.
Yeah.
Like, when you need to have a release that bad, then that's also a hard time. So, yeah.
Today, just going through the clips, and there's so much. This American Life helps that, because you can listen to old monologues and also excerpts from God Says Ha. And also the other stuff that you've done. There's TED Talks. There's everything. But they're all excerpts from the work that you ultimately put on stage as part of this process we're talking about tonight. Do you like the concept that I can just kind of jump into a moment in your life or a time and get that moment in bite-sized pieces on YouTube or bite-sized pieces on a radio clip?
No, it's terrible.
Something that was designed for the stage in that moment in that intimate setting.
I don't delineate that so much. I just, like, sometimes I think I wake up in my body and it's almost like somebody's handed me a piece of paper of who I am. And on the piece of paper it says, you've been telling really personal stories that are out there. You know, like, and that's upsetting to me. Because I think, my personality isn't, I mean, obviously one part of me obviously needs to get on stage and tell personal stories. But another part of me is really private and embarrassed and doesn't like people who do that and doesn't want to be a person who does that. And then, so that's embarrassing to me.
Is that something that has been with you your whole comedic career, where you have that juxtaposition about personal stories?
In fact, I was at the Groundlings, that's how I started doing sketch comedy. And sometimes I'd go out on stage as myself, but almost never. And my friend Kathy Griffin was there when I was there, and she was starting to do the same thing, like getting out on stage and talking as herself, not just in character. Then I went to SNL. I never appeared as myself one single time at SNL. And then I came back, and Kathy was doing these. She's the one who got me to go to the Uncabaret. And she goes, just talk as yourself. And I had a snobby thing about it. I was like, you know, my personality is not for sale, Kathy. That's for my friends and my loved ones. And it felt like you were selling yourself. Like, it was too intimate. It's more intimate than sex. I mean, it's very intimate.
And the things that you talk about on stage are very intimate.
And I didn't like it. But then she was like, oh, but it was funny when you were talking about this and that. So I go, I know, but that's for you as a friend. That isn't just to give away to strangers. But then I guess I got over it, because then she drugged me to the Uncab. She started this thing called Hot Cup of Talk. And so she got me, and there's Margaret Cho and Janine Garofalo. That was the first one, so it was just the four of us.
Wow.
And we would get up and just talk about anything. And the whole point is, it wasn't supposed to be stand-up. It was supposed to be real stuff, but entertaining.
At the time, were you trying to push back against the idea that everything was stand-up or improv?
The whole, like, the Uncab started to help stand-ups break out of their routines. And so the rules were whatever you said had to be the first time you ever said it. It could not be polished material. If you had ever said it before in a professional setting, you could not say it. It's changed a little bit now, but that was the original idea. And there couldn't be jokes or punchlines. And it had to be absolutely true. You couldn't make up stuff. It couldn't be exaggerated, except for how everyone exaggerates everything. But it couldn't be stand-up be exaggerated. But I'd never done stand-up. So for me, I didn't have to break out of that. That was just, I was just talking like I would talk at a dinner party. I just was speaking like I would talk anywhere.
You see a lot, like a resurgence, explosion, if you will, of storytelling showcases and people in Chicago.
Well, no, because the Moth, like, that started this whole thing. And it really, okay, so last June when I realized my directing career was not taking off right now, and I thought, okay, I'm going to see if I can do this. Oh, because there's this other thing that I had a couple of people who really, older comedians, Bob Newhart being one and Phyllis Diller being another one, who really liked what I did and sought me out. And Phyllis Diller, like, she really liked me. And I loved, I mean, like,
how
that. And
that,
we couldn't be more different in what we do. I mean, she's really one-liner and joke, one-line joke. But she'd say, Julia, you are getting as many laughs, which, by the way, is not true. I don't get as many laughs as, like, a Jim Gaffigan who's going to get 10 laughs a minute. I mean, like, I get 4 laughs a minute or 5. But she made me, I didn't even know how to think like that. And so she made me think about it. So then, you know, she's passed away, but which is sad. But then in June, I thought, I'm just going to watch a stand-up every day for the summer. That's my summer. Every day, I'm going to watch a different one. And I'm going to get, I got the, on DVD, I got all the George Carlin stuff. And I just thought, let's just have a survey. And it was really interesting to watch because I feel like what Bob Newhart was doing and Bill Cosby was doing, and even George Carlin to a certain extent, although he did more jokey stuff, it really was more conversation. Then it became more stand-up-y the way that we thought. Then this whole alternative thing came in and people started telling stories again. And now I feel like stand-up is a lot more like what we were trying to do at the Uncabaret.
Right.
But in a way, it's a lot more like some of the original people were doing, too. It's storytelling.
Cyclical, yeah. Julia Sweeney's my guest in studio tonight. She's got a new show, a showcase slash workshop, Julia Sweeney, Older and Wider. It's running through March 18th at Judy's Beat Lounge at Second City. Julia Sweeney, of course, a longtime actress, writer, former cast member on Saturday Night Live. We'll continue the conversation. Let's take a break. We'll get an update on tonight's news, and we'll continue the conversation here at the Big Table with Julia Sweeney. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest in studio tonight at the Big Table, Julia Sweeney. She's got a new show called Julia Sweeney, Older and Wider. It's through March 18th at Judy's Beat Lounge, Second City. It's a showcase slash workshop as she's doing, what did you say, 14 of these?
14 shows,
to essentially try out some new material that could be for a project.
See if it's something. And, if I have something.
I love the course of this conversation as we talk about the history of this kind of performance because, you know, you said you came up with The Groundlings, which is sketch comedy and characters. Saturday Night Live is sketch comedy and characters.
Right.
Even when someone is on the news update and and is acting like they're themselves, they're not really themselves.
No.
Stand-ups will act as if they're telling their stories, they're themselves, but it's an act. It's a character.
Yeah.
You have found a way to pierce through that in your post-SNL career, and with the help of This American Life, people know you as a personal monologuist in a way that you've told very personal stories about your health, your family's health, religion, spirituality, faith. You've really put everything that's happening in your personal life on stage. And to hear you tonight talking
not
about
everything.
Well, we haven't seen the new stuff yet, so I'm sure it is everything. I guess that's the question I'm getting to. Is there a line that you draw to say, hey, I'm not going to talk about this?
Oh, my God, there's so many lines. There's so many lines. Yeah, you know, there's people you love that you care about. You can't talk that openly about it. You have to, like, one thing that made it hard being married with a kid, like, I feel like your parents are fair game. Your parents are always fair game. And your siblings are pretty much fair game. I think they're 75% fair game.
Because it's your relationship that
you're
really
steering.
Yeah, and
also you didn't choose who your brothers and sisters are.
Right,
you didn't choose who your parents are. But your spouse and your kid, you can't do that.
Right.
Even though I have to say, Michael and Mulan, my husband and daughter, are so, they are constantly coming up with material for me. And actually, my daughter, who had her, she's 18 now, but she had her first big, you know, falling in love with this boy. And it was a hilarious experience because we got to know this boy too, and we really loved him. He was very, very quiet. But anyway, it's a longer story. But we got to know him. We took him on a 3-week camping trip one summer. He's 2 years older. And then we found out that he voted for Trump. And our family lost its mind. And we did not handle it well. And we tried to handle it well. And we did not handle it well in very funny ways.
Did you
ways.
Find this Each out in the us. Camping trip?
No, oh, we didn't good, find good. It out. No, no, that was the summer later. Before.
Okay, okay, good.
And by the way, we were talking, and you know, we're big progressives, so we have our, but we talked about it. We talk about politics constantly. There's no way you could not know.
He just
now,
was that quiet. That doesn't
mean that if somebody's voting differently, that's fine with us. We are happy there's choices, but we would expect that if you were with for 3 weeks with somebody in a car,
yeah,
going across country
up,
right. in a tent every night, it would come up. And also for my daughter, then she had to deal with that first time that you're dating somebody and you realize they're not who you thought they were. And then she had her own inner drama, and there was many, and it kind of culminated in this big confrontation with him, because then we couldn't figure out why. We wanted to know what kind of Trump voter he was. Like, was he a scary Trump voter? We were trying to go like, well, what would be the acceptable reasons? You know, like, and so we were trying to give him the, anyway, it ended up at this big dinner and Mulan, it escalated. Michael, my husband, who's so quiet, started getting into a big fight with this kid. And he was really like our kid. Like, you don't understand. For 2 years, we had spent so much time with him. And then Mulan broke the tension saying a very funny thing. That well, I'm not going to say it because it won't be funny here. But if you come to my show, you'll hear it. And it was so funny. And then the whole how it came down was so funny. So I thought, well, I can't tell that story. So I was talking to Mulan, getting ready for the show. This is like a couple months ago. And I go, I'll tell you, Mulan, I would never tell that story. But you know, the story I wish I could tell is about Justin and voting for Trump. And she goes, Mom, you got to tell it.
You got to tell it.
You got to tell it, Mom.
She's a writer. That's
and
good.
And I go, but like, she comes off like a nut, too. We all come off like nuts. It's like somebody pulled the plug on all
of
us.
Do you have to audition the story? Do you have to do it in front of your family? Like, this is how I'm going to tell it? And they give you notes?
Yeah,
things
no,
like that?
Yeah. No, I did. And then also people are remembering different things.
Oh, that's great.
So then I actually have to say I'm so proud of Mulan, because Mulan is a very private, pretty quiet person herself. She's not really given to comedy. Like, she likes to watch comedy, but she's not particularly funny herself and doesn't often get it, you know. And so for her to know that story had to be told.
Great timing.
It made me so proud of her. It was like my proudest moment as a parent. Like, you understood that we had to throw Justin under the bus. You got it. We do. And so she's excited about that part.
All right, there you go.
So see, that part.
That's how you can get personal stuff in.
Yeah, exactly.
Julia Sweeney, my guest in studio. It's an interesting time we live in, obviously with politics. And we've heard from a lot of comics, a lot of your peers and others who have talked about how the world has changed and how they'll get up on stage, maybe in front of a college or in an audience, and they'll tell the same jokes they told in 1991, 1992, and they tell it now, and the context is wrong, and it's offensive.
Right.
I think of you and the way that you have been able to avoid all of that by telling personal stories about yourself. I think of a lot of the stuff that Pat comes to mind as one that probably if Saturday Night Live trotted out a Pat character in 2017 or 18 now.
Well, I've thought a lot about that.
I don't know if it would go over.
Well, I think it would, but Pat couldn't have the personality that Pat had. Because you have to understand that when I created Pat, the androgyny part was an afterthought. It was really because I couldn't come off as a guy. It was based on a guy. So I was trying to be a guy, but I couldn't really convincingly play a guy. So I thought, I'll just throw in a joke about it being androgynous to cover for my lack of acting.
That's interesting.
Then that became the thing. And then I think for way too long, even for me, I held on to Pat's annoying qualities because the androgyny part actually wasn't that interesting to me. The part that was interesting was Pat's annoying behavior. But now I think, because then all these people, like intersex people, started contacting me, liking Pat. And I think, you shouldn't like Pat. Pat is terrible. But I think you're great. You know, but then they liked it. And I feel like if I did Pat again, or I won't do Pat again, but if I could go back and do it over, I would absolutely do Pat. But I would not make Pat so unlikable. Like, I basically, if I knew Pat was going to be so popular, I wouldn't have made Pat so gross.
Is
because
that
was actually a separate thing, being gross from being androgynous.
Is that a condition of popularity? Is that where Pat started and then became a recurring character, became something you put on T-shirts, and became the thing that Saturday Night Live was known for at the time?
Yeah.
Did those traits, those annoying traits, kind of get amplified because it became less and less about the character and more about the bit?
I don't know. And yes and no. I mean, because to me, what was more... First of all, playing androgynous isn't playing anything. So to me, I liked as an actor playing the annoying parts of Pat. And we did the jokes were all really about people not knowing how to deal with Pat. It really wasn't at Pat's expense. Like even the song that we came up with, a ma'am or a sir, accept him or her, whatever it might be. It was all about accepting Pat. And all the jokes were about people not being able to accept Pat. On the other hand, Pat was a gross character. You know what I mean? Like, so it was a gross... I mean, so, yeah, I don't know.
Well, I guess what I want to know is, you know, as you talk about... We've spent a lot of time talking about your career and your relationship with telling personal stories.
Right.
When you think back to that time at SNL or even the Groundlings, and you think about the characters you've created over time, do they get the same treatment of the work that you go back and listen to the God Said Ha stuff or to any of the other personal stories? And you kind of go,
I can't listen to the personal stories because it's just too painful. Or maybe I'm not disciplined enough. But in this show, I am
painful
gonna talk-
because. Because of the personal story, because of the what you were going through at the time, or because you're, as a performer, going, oh, why did I do that? Why did I do that?
Well, okay. I have to say, I can't think of stuff right now, and maybe that's wrong. I should be thinking. I can't think of stuff that, like, was not politically correct that you can't say now, but you could say then. I can't think of stuff I did aside from creating Pat, which is a huge thing. I mean, but other than that...
I don't specifically mean all of the comedy that you did for SNL, but it is interesting to think about some of the things that were pop culture...
Yeah.
Talk about pop culture moments. Pat was it. And you think about that's a great character to think of 2018 to go, would Pat be a pop culture moment? Would
this is what I come to in the show, and I don't know if this will be funny enough to make the final show, but my idea, first of all, I have this whole thing about Matt Lauer calling me, just this is 3 years ago, saying, Pat's my favorite character, let's do Pat for Halloween on the Today Show. And I was like, I don't know if you can do Pat now. Like, I don't, and what would you do? And he's like, oh, no, you can. And I was like, I can't even think of a situation that Pat could be in right now. And then we actually did come up with something. And we did it. We did a whole Halloween thing. Me and Matt Lauer both dressed as Pat. I mean, like, that's a whole other story. But in that moment, that I had forgotten about Pat in some ways. And then the whole transgender thing is such a big part of the world now, which, of course, I'm all for acceptance of those people. I'm those people. But you know what I mean? Like, yeah. I'm with everybody. We're all evolving. And then I had this moment when I was on the phone with Matt Lauer where I thought, oh, my God, I was the Al Jolson of androgyny. Oh, my God. Like, and I got – it's actually – I have tingles on me now. Like, not – like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Okay, so then I think it through and think it through. Of course, I'm defensive. You know, I'm like, but we weren't making fun of the androgyny. Yeah, right, we were making fun of the people's – you know, like I have this whole defensive monologue that just erupts in my head. But then I came to a new – way of looking at it. No, I was not the Al Jolson of androgyny. Pat was the Uncle Tom of androgyny. Okay, so then I go and I think, okay, then I read Uncle Tom's Cabin because I have this epiphany that Pat's the Uncle Tom of androgyny, meaning that it was sincerely done. It was too much of a stereotype, or maybe it was too broad.
Sure, yeah.
But it brought something to light to the popular culture that maybe moved us all along, even though that particular character was. So then I reread Uncle Tom. Or no, I don't reread it. I read it. I never read it. And then I want to do a whole thing in the show, Justin, about reading that book, because now I realize that Uncle Tom was not an Uncle Tom. Uncle Tom has been unfairly called Uncle Tom because...
That's how you get...
Uncle Tom, he was not sucking up to the white man. He was religious. I mean, if there's anything about Uncle Tom is that he was too religious because he felt like he had to do this because God wanted him to do it. And also, when they sent him off of the farm and sold him downriver, which was the worst thing that could happen, and what people thought was Uncle Tom about him is that he didn't run away or do something, he knew that his family would be punished if he did that. He had to do it. So then I became incredibly defensive of Uncle Tom. Like, Uncle Tom should not be called an Uncle Tom. Uncle Tom should just be Uncle Tom from Uncle Tom's Cabin.
All this relating back to Pat, and you're like, well,
I know. And then, so I have all that that I'm going to try out in my show, but I don't know if the audience is going to be going, okay, wow, big dissertation on Uncle Tom and how Uncle Tommy Pat is.
Like, and they'll flip the lights. You did your 45 minutes. You're like, right. Oh, we only got to one story.
That was really interesting, not particularly funny. Food for thought.
As we wrap up, the world knows you in so many different ways. You've had a career in which we talk about Pat and SNL, and people know you as that is an honorable place, because among comedians who have been cast members, there's a very small percentage of comedians who've had that distinction and that honor. At the same time, you have been able to skip the trappings of being a wacky sitcom star and continuing your Hollywood career to do something that is completely pioneered at the time as well with the personal stories, and you continue to do that. Do you see it that way? Do you see yourself as...
No, but I love you describing it that way. But, I mean, because there's this other part of me that's like, why didn't I get those parts on those shows? You make a lot of money doing that.
You do make the money, and maybe you missed the money boat. But do you see it? I mean, is that something, you know, as you
I
think
do
about...
Now. Yeah. Now that I'm older, I do. At the time, I just thought, oh, I'm just telling stuff. What I really want is this. I would love a sitcom job. That's what I really always wanted. This was all... I was telling all these stories as a means to get my sitcom job that I never got.
A reel.
And then I kind of quit show business. And then that gave me a lot of time to sort of reflect. And I feel like every single person sort of finds themselves waking up in their life going, oh, so this is what I did. Oh, this is what I got good at. Or this is what I was me. So I feel like the last couple of years has been this sort of acceptance about it. Because I guess there's been a part of me that's embarrassed about... I mean, it's like I said, it's embarrassing that I get up and tell these stories. It is embarrassing to me. It's hard. It's a conflict. But I'm also proud of it. And I also am now just accepting it.
I think of a lot of great
monologues. It is a craft. I will say that. It's a craft. It takes a lot of work to craft it, to make it right. But, yeah.
But embarrassing.
And embarrassing. And whatever. And then I think, you know, your life just goes a certain way. It's so funny. It's not, I don't believe in God. And I don't believe in fate in any kind of supernatural way. But we all find ourselves in a life. And we all find ourselves doing a certain thing. And I guess I have a new appreciation that this was my thing. Mm. Like, it's okay. Like, I guess I'm telling myself, it's okay that you did it.
It's an okay thing. Julia Sweeney, my guest tonight, she's new show, Case/Workshop. Julia Sweeney, Older and Wider, is going to be at Judy's Beat Lounge at Second City through March 18th, right there at Piper's Alley at Wells and North and Old Town. Julia, a pleasure to have you tonight. Thanks so much for stopping by.
This was really fun.
Fun to catch up with Julia Sweeney. I used to do I had her on one of my episodes. I did a video project called the Wikipedia Files. And in the Wikipedia Files is a very simple concept. Sometimes simple is better. It was essentially fact check the Wikipedia pages of the stars. They might have talked about it on this program before. I did it about 5-10 years ago. My first one I ever did was with Julia Sweeney. And I remember in that, because I went back to look at it while I was doing the research for the interview. But it's pretty cleaned up. A lot of the times, the stars, especially by this point, that's why the bit doesn't really work anymore, because everybody learned how to clean theirs up. So the fun inaccuracies and possible mistakes or fun stories that are embarrassing, they're not in them anymore. You know, it used to be, people saw Julia Sweeney at a party over in Rogers Park, and it was a total blast, and she was totally drunk. Did this happen? Like, that's not in there anymore. They clean them up. So anyway, but I remember that she was, and we didn't talk about it here, but she had controversy on SNL because she had played Chelsea Clinton in a sketch where she put braces on and they... kind of made her out to look like Chelsea Clinton. And it was the first of the you can't make fun of the kids of presidents. And even though the fury was at SNL, she took on some of the brunt of it, and she told the story of it was really funny where she told the story where the press or whoever it was came out and they're like, such a Like this, it's what an ugly representation. I mean, they made Chelsea look ugly and, you know, unlikable. And she's like, they just put a wig on me.
Yeah, it was just her face.
Her face. Her didn't deal with, like, imagine if she had to deal with that in the internet age. You know, I mean, that was 20 years ago. So, but anyway, Julia Sweeney. And it is a fascinating look back. You start looking at not just Pat, but some of the characters from Saturday Night Live that were really, really hot. They were pop cultural icons. You think about there. You would walk into the Spencer's Gifts, and there would be T-shirts and mugs and calendars with It's Pat.
Yeah,
remember that? Oh, like that man. wasn't just a recurring character for her. It was Saturday Night Live's. We're putting this up on the front.
Yeah, that was a thing.
And the idea of possibly, you know, having it fall out of favor. Could you do Pat in 2018? Could you make fun of androgyny? And she breaks down the fact that that's not what necessarily what the joke was. But on the surface, and I think what Saturday Night Live was pushing, especially in their marketing, not necessarily what Julia and the writers were doing, was this was a character that you didn't know what the sex was. How funny is that? Right? That's a big deal. But she's I can't stress enough, when you listen to, if you get a chance to go find the tapes at Uncabaret, where she is off the cuff, improvising, telling a story on stage, nervous. This would have been in the, maybe the 90s, mid-90s maybe. But talking about her life, talking about her brother, talking about her family, talking about cancer. But doing it in a way that it was just, you just don't hear it like that anymore. You just don't hear someone who's trying and experimenting and having it on record. And this was the stuff that they played on This American Life with Ira Glass. And that turned into the God Says Ha show that she did. So, but when you listen to those tapes, it was stark. I really enjoyed it. It was raw. It was energetic. It was this comic dealing with something and performing it in a way that wasn't polished, but that made it great. So if you can find those tapes, check them out. They're online. I found them when I was doing the research for it. But yeah, really great. Julia Sweeney, go check her out at Judy's Beat Lounge, named after Judy Fabchance, a friend of mine who died of cancer as well.
Oh.
Yeah, they named the Beat Lounge Theater there after Judy. All right, coming up, we got a great hour here. We're going to talk about art meeting science, the art and beauty of bacteria. And then we're also going to talk about craft coffee. Maybe it's time for me to throw away my old drip machine and join the revolution, Pete. Maybe I need to get into the specialty craft realm, start getting a scale, you know? That's what I'm thinking about. Whenever I think about that in the book, in Jessica Easto's great book, there's all these tools you use to make coffee, and the scale and the kettle and all this kind of stuff. And all I could think about was the scene in Goodfellas when Ray Liotta's making cocaine. You know, and that's not like all those instruments are the same instruments that are used for craft coffee. Go figure. So we'll talk about craft coffee coming up here in the 9 o'clock hour. It's a download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up at the 9:30 segment, we're going to talk with Jessica Easto about her new book, Craft Coffee, a Manual. It takes a look at not just specialty coffee versus craft coffee, meaning making it at home or independent brew, but also talking about the history of the coffee bean in America. It's a great read. I really enjoyed it. I'm not much. I drink coffee, as does 64%. I think the study in the book said 64% of us drink daily. And it was interesting to see how far the industry has come to where we are in 2018, to when the colonies were settled in America back in the day, and people were frying coffee beans to make coffee. So that conversation coming up 9:30 tonight in our industry night segment. Well, our next segment is about bacteria. No, not the probiotics craze or the new story that gut bacteria may have wiped out millions in an ancient Mexican civilization. Nope. This is a story about the art of bacteria. Artist and Loyola University Chicago biology professor Hunter Cole has a new exhibit at the ARC Gallery in Bucktown. It's called Living Light, Photographs by Light of Bioluminescent Bacteria. Cole uses photographs of human figures and illuminates them with glowing blue light created by bacteria. The exhibit also features liquid cultures as paint and also displays photography of glowing petri dishes. It's stirring work that once again proves that art and science are, as the artist says, mutually inclusive. Hunter Cole, my guest tonight on The Download, thanks for being here.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
This is the art is striking. It's amazing. You have a background. I mean, as reading your story, talk first about how art and science interact. I mean, for you to be a biology professor but also an artist, is that unique?
It is relatively unique, but the field is growing and booming. Like, I started working in art and science about 20 years ago, and there was kind of a handful of people doing it, and now it's just this boom. There's, like, a lot more people doing it now, so.
It feels very right brain, left brain, in the way that if you're going to be someone who studies science, you know, you're going to have a particular style as opposed to someone who's an artist. I mean, is that as a safe categorization, or is that sort of thrown out the window?
I don't think necessarily. I think they can, you know, they are cooperative in the sense that a lot of people associate art with being creative and whimsical, and people associate with science with facts and structure. But to be at the edge of science, you have to be very creative to figure out how things are going on. And, you know, art, like, science gives art subject matter and new media and new topics and new ways of doing things. And by combining the two, you can even make advancements in both fields.
And there's many that are of course, well-skilled in both arts and science. But the idea of using bacteria in the way that you're using bioluminescent bacteria, where does this come from? This is an amazing style of art. Where does it come from?
Well, I started getting involved in art and science back in 1997, but I didn't get introduced. I actually was an adjunct professor at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and a professor there who works with bioluminescence, he actually drew a picture of a heart for Valentine's Day for his wife in bioluminescent bacteria, and which is kind of funny because one of the functions of bioluminescence is to attract a mate. So I thought that was very interesting.
Is that how the light is created, or why it's created?
That's one of the reasons. There's other reasons like predator-prey interactions. You know, there's like camouflage. There's all sorts of like mechanisms for bioluminescence in nature. But anyway, so I saw the idea from him drawing this heart, and I said, like, oh, I can do a lot with this. So,
well, is there a specific kind of bacteria that bioluminescence comes off of?
There are several bioluminescent bacteria. A couple of common ones are Vibrio, Fischeri.
Sure.
Photobacterium phosphorium.
And where do you find these bacteria? I mean, you brought with you. You got a bag, and you said, "Here, I want to show you." And you walked into the bathroom right on the side here, and you showed this glowing. Where does that come from?
It's naturally, this particular bacteria is naturally found in a fish gut in the ocean, and it just like proliferates in the fish gut. And I don't know how to say this maybe on the radio, but the fish releases it, the fish swallows it, the fish releases it, and just proliferates in the fish gut. So that's just how it survives.
Does it take time to mature, like to get the light to, I mean,
how am I culturing it?
Yeah.
So I culture it like in a liquid culture, like overnight. And then I use the liquid culture to either use paintbrushes or Q-tips. And then I paint on the petri dishes. And then it gets its brightest in about 24 hours and then gradually dies off for 2 weeks. So those petri dishes you saw were about 5 days old. So they were kind of dimmer.
So there's a specific time for you to be able to create the art. It's not like, I mean, you have to be inspired and ready to go when that stuff is ready to go.
Yeah, there's actually quite a bit of planning that goes into, I mean, some of the drawings I do are spontaneous, but there's can be a lot of planning into doing the drawing or doing the setups with the human figures and things like that. Like ordering my latest series, the Bioluminescent Nudes, I ordered costumes from France and Los Angeles and had to like get the models and you know, had to get the assistants, and I had 20 people the day before drawing lilies on petri dishes and for 600 petri dishes. So yeah, it takes a lot of planning and effort.
this is amazing. And I, at the end of the day, I mean, you're drawing the and correct me if I'm wrong, and I'm trying my best to stay with this because it's fascinating to me, but it will stop being lit at some point, right?
I mean, on the petri dishes.
Yeah, on the dishes.
Yes.
So you really do have a time where you have to put that, it's the photography that's the art.
Correct.
Is that right? So you do the art, you get in the moment, you got it within the window of time that you have, whatever many days, and you take the photography. That's what we could see in the
exhibit.
ARC gallery.
That is correct. But there is one opportunity, okay. Or I don't know if you want me to bring it
yes,
up now.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
That's okay. So the closing reception of the show is January 27th, 4 to 6, and there will be live bacterial drawing. So the living bacteria will be glowing for you to see, not just the photographs. Even though the photographs are awesome, but there'll be living, glowing bacteria for you to see.
I can only imagine with all the planning and preparation as an artist and knowing and understanding the science that goes into this. There's a lot of trial and error. I would
yes,
assume that in your career of trying to understand, even seeing the heart drawn by your colleague, even to get to where you're at, you recognize that sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Talk about the trial and error of understanding how to use this bacteria for art.
Well, one of the things I've done that's kind of, because there's other people who have used bioluminescence in their art, but one of the things that I do that's a little bit novel is that I photograph them as, instead of just photographing them at their brightest, I photograph them as they grow and as they die. And one of the things I did, I created it, which is at the ARC gallery, I created a morphing movie of that. And the music for that movie is based on protein sequence in the bacteria that relates to the bioluminescence. So the music even relates to the bacteria.
I love it. We are talking with artist Hunter Cole. She is a biology professor at Loyola University as well as an artist. Her new exhibit is at the ARC Gallery in Bucktown. It's called Living Light, Photographs by Light of Bioluminescent Bacteria. We're talking about the process and how these how art and science intersect and are mutually inclusive. We'll continue the conversation. Let's take a quick break. I don't even think the web camera can pick up the bioluminescence that's in the room right now. But Hunter Cole is my guest tonight. We'll take a quick break and we'll continue the conversation. Stay with us. It's the download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me, artist Hunter Cole, also biology professor at Loyola University. She's got a new exhibit at the ARC Gallery in Bucktown, right on Milwaukee. It's called Living Light, Photographs by Light of Bioluminescent Bacteria. She uses photographs of human figures and illuminates them with the glowing blue light created by bacteria. Bioluminescence, I'm learning a ton about this, Hunter. I realize it is the same. We were just talking in the break about there's the reaction that is bioluminescent. We see that like in lightning bugs or glow
Correct.
Sticks, right? That's
yes.
Essentially that's the idea.
Right.
But you're going one step further by using the bacteria that uses bioluminescence to create the art.
Yes.
I got it. All right. Good.
You got it.
All right. I have a question. The 630 has a question about they've only seen blue and purple colors when it comes to this kind of work, so they're familiar with the work. Are there other colors involved in this?
Well, bioluminescent bacteria that I use are kind of a blue-green light, and a very common color of bioluminescence is that kind of blue light, and that's because that's the wavelength that's most easily seen deep in the oceans, so that's the most common color of bioluminescence. But there are other organisms that are bioluminescent, like fireflies, which are green, and there are certain worms that have red bioluminescence. So there are some different colors. And there are mushrooms that are bioluminescent. And if you get into fluorescence, which is a little different, activated by UV light, there's a whole array of colors. Kind of, you have a whole like kind of crayon box.
As an artist and a scientist, you're in a unique position where you can both be able to be artistic and understand how to use the science, meaning just as you just mentioned, the bioluminescent, understanding where the colors come from and what produces it. Does that help you along the way to understand the properties that create bioluminescence or the bacteria that's used to help you with your art, to help you with the product that you use for the art?
Well, like I say, like doing the time-lapse photography and seeing like the different stages, and that's kind of that's like a process, and doing bracketed photography, and, you know, to see like getting the best results possible. So it's a little bit of research on the art and the science side.
And I would ask the same question from the other side, as you know, when it comes to your art as an artist, how does it help you in your scientific research when you see a protein sequence or you see the bacteria that's having, are you automatically, is your brain automatically going, that's art, that's cool, I want to put that in an art project?
Well, yeah, I actually did, back a while back in 2003, I did a series of, there were seminars. It was actually also at University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and they have colloquia. Every week they would have a new scientist come in and give a seminar. And I did these drawings, and the drawings were like, you know, the regular drawings with pen and ink. And I would limit the drawing to when they started their talk, the drawing would end when their talk ended, and it had words and figures and all that kind of thing. And so I was like processing their scientific talk through both language that's both, you know,
right,
drawn and written.
Yeah, that's intriguing, because what you do specifically now, even with this exhibit, is in the same family, in the way that you're interpreting the scientific, what's happening on the science side, and creating something on the art side.
Right, right.
Okay, so you teach at Loyola University, and you teach incoming students, science students, a lot of different areas of expertise. But I'm interested in how you weave art and artistic and creativity and things like that into your science lectures, and what you're teaching the students who come in with science backgrounds.
Well, I do teach pure science courses. Like, I teach a genetics laboratory, and I will insert artistic examples a lot of times to relate to the topic at hand. Like Joe Davis or Eduardo Katz, it's in genetic engineering, you know, for the purposes of art and things of that nature. But I also, so I interweave that into my pure science classes, and they just find it fun and interesting and engaging. But I also teach a course called Biology Through Art, which is a course for non-science majors, but biology majors still take it because they want to see outside the box. And they do things, they do activities too. So they get to see like microscopic organisms like amoeba and paramecium, and I have them do an interpretive painting of it. I'm like, no, not a scientific illustration. I don't want you to just draw it. You got to think outside the box. Their movement, Jackson Pollock, you know.
Is it hard to get someone outside of that comfort zone, especially if you're being taught science and that's what you do?
Yeah, no, they think like, no, I have this, that's what I was saying. I had this one student, Sonia, that like, she was a biology major and she just really wanted to draw the paramecium or something or the amoeba. And I said, that's okay, but you could have that part of the painting, but have something else too. But then I got her totally off of the other end, like I said, the Jackson Pollock, and I had her, she ended up doing a splatter painting relating to the movement of the protozoans moving really fast under the microscope. So I thought that was a real success story because I got her to go 180, you know.
How does it help Sonia and other students who might be going into scientific research as a career, getting into what I would consider to be a buttoned-up industry, in the way that, you know, there's a lot of experiments and research and things that are done a specific particular way? How does creativity, art, and what you're teaching help them as they become more proficient in their careers?
I think sometimes in science, you know, not the great scientists or the good scientists, but sometimes in science people get stuck on an idea and they want to keep doing experiments to like fit their idea, but their idea is wrong. And so instead of like trying to get the experiments to fit your idea, look at what the experiments are telling you. And I think if you have that, you know, inspiration, that creativity, or that way of thinking outside the box, you might look at not just, oh, it must work this way, I must do experiment to prove this way. Oh, maybe it could work this way or that way, you know? And so you're more creative, and I think that inspires the science and inspires the discovery in science.
Was there a point in your career, and I think about this because you mentioned that, you know, it's been over 20 years now, that you were like, I got to do one or the other. I'm going to be an artist or a scientist. They're really not mutually inclusive. I have to pick one. Was there a moment in your life where you had a come to Jesus moment where you're like, this is what I have to do. I have to put the other thing aside.
It was kind of the opposite, actually. I actually, well, growing up in San Francisco, I was exposed to art and science. My dad took me. So in San Francisco and Golden Gate Park, on one side, there's a DeYoung Museum. The other side was the Academy of Sciences Museum. So almost every weekend, we'd go to both museums. So I was exposed to art and science very young. But my education was leaned towards the science. I thought that's what I could get a career in and everything. So my education was the science. And then in the middle of graduate school in genetics, I was a little frustrated with the science. Like I say, like, I kind of a little bit had a professor who wanted it one way, and it wasn't fitting that way, and it was frustrating. So then I kind of turned to the art for inspiration, and then I started integrating art and science. So it wasn't really like picking one. It was like they just kind of came together.
Can you imagine a life where you did pick one? If you were a scientist right now, could you imagine a life without art, or an artist without science?
No, I wouldn't like that. I like them both together.
It's a hypothetical. So.
I mean, I do like, I do have ideas for some art projects that are just pure art projects. But I really, a lot of my ideas for projects do integrate art and science, and that's mainly what I do.
So. Okay, so coming up on the 27th, it'll be the final night of the exhibit,
correct.
January 27th, you can see live painting with the bacteria.
Yeah, from 4 to 6, yes.
From 4 to 6 o'clock, that's at the ARC Gallery up on Milwaukee and Bucktown. I think the address is 2154 or somewhere in there.
I think it's Damon, yeah.
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 Anyway, Hunter Cole in studio tonight, the scientist and artist. She's a biology professor at the Loyola University of Chicago, and she has a new exhibit at the ARC Gallery in Bucktown. It's called Living Light, Photographs by Light of Bioluminescent Bacteria. It's on display until, I think, till the 27th, right? That's
correct.
The last day. And you could see her painting live from 4 to 6 with some of the bacteria as it's still in bioluminescent form. Is that
correct?
Did I got
yeah,
it?
It's
yeah.
Still, yes.
Look
it's
at
still
me.
Bioluminescent, yes.
Hunter, it's a pleasure to meet you. And congrats on the exhibit and the stunning work. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Rob. It's a download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up in 10 o'clock hour tonight, we play The Worst, where we complain about the worst things in society for prizes. We've got pizza. Claire Zulke and Hassan Ali will be here. Looking forward to playing The Worst. I got a lot of worst, winter-related worst. I'm sure Pete's got them as well. 312-981-7200. We'll do that in the 10 o'clock hour. Well, it's time for Industry Night. We were going to do this last night, but with Martin Luther King Day, we switched it till tonight. My next guest is the author of the new book, Craft Coffee, A Manual. In it, Jessica Isto gives the reader a history lesson on coffee, from the early colonists frying coffee beans to our obsession with cream and sugar. Isto maps the history but also talks about the new movement dedicated to better understanding the bean and making the perfect cup of coffee at home. And this is really a segment for all of us, as a 2014 study found that over 60% of Americans drink coffee on a daily basis. The book is great, and I'm this close to throwing away my old drip coffee machine and joining the craft coffee revolution. This close. Jessica Isto, welcome to the download.
Thank you for having me.
Nice to meet you. All right, so first off, writing this book, your husband is sort of a craft coffee connoisseur. Talk about what made you write this book to essentially craft coffee, a manual, brewing a better cup at home.
So I kind of, since my husband is in the craft coffee industry, I sort of have an outsider-insider perspective into it. And I had been brewing coffee at home before I met him, and he taught me a lot of things along the way. But being involved in it, I kind of started to realize that there's a gap between what craft coffee professionals know and sort of what consumers understand. And I thought of writing a book sort of in layman's terms and laying it all out for people to sort of pick and choose what they care to know about would be a good way to sort of close that.
Well, gap. It's interesting, too, because it was fun to hear about all the obviously in the book, there's an index of all the terminology that a lot of people are intimidated by when it comes to brewing coffee. But one of the names that I remember is specialty coffee. This idea that used to be called what wasn't sold in the stores, specialty coffee. And that needs to change at a certain point. It's changed and morphed into craft coffee because there's so many independent brewers out there that are actually doing things and creating new ways to brew coffee.
Yeah, so coffee, I guess, as it's understood, is sort of broken up into three different waves. So the first wave was really from the time when big coffee companies like Folgers and Maxwell House started rising to prominence, and it was all about delivering caffeine to the masses in the most convenient way possible. And then in the late 60s and the 70s, the second wave emerged, and it was the specialty coffee movement, and it was focused on high quality coffee. Not all beans are the same. And that was really led by places like Starbucks and Peet's Coffee.
Right. I didn't realize that Starbucks went as far back. It was 1971 or 1968 in that area where I think Starbucks is a pure 90s phenomenon or 2000s phenomenon, but it's been around for a long time.
Yeah. And so the umbrella of specialty coffee, after a while, there was a new branch, what some people call third wave coffee, what I call craft coffee, sort of emerged under the umbrella of specialty coffee. So craft coffee is specialty coffee, but it just kind of has a different ethos. So there are a few distinguishing characteristics, which you sort of already mentioned. These craft coffee professionals tend to elevate the status of the bean as an ingredient.
Mm-hmm.
They care about where it came from, how it was processed.
Ethics play a big role in craft coffee.
For sure. And they believe that the highest skill level at every stage of the process results in the best possible cup of coffee. So that goes all the way from the producers to the processors, to the roasters, and then finally to people like us, the brewers, or the professional counterpart baristas.
I always think about it, and you know, there were so many. I worked at a Starbucks. I worked in independent coffee shops as well in my life, and I remember there being an emphasis and an understanding, or at least an education, that was much more high-end than you would think, meaning this is what this bean is, this is how to treat the bean, this is how long it can be here, this is how, you don't really get into espresso in the book, but this is how long this should take for the shot. But there's so many things that go into it that a lot of consumers don't even think about. And I wonder how much of that gets in the way of them exploring it because they're just afraid of what they don't know.
Yeah, I think like the jargon that comes around with it, or all this new terminology, can be intimidating. So I talk about in the book how Starbucks was around and kicking since before I started drinking coffee. And so a lot of us have grown up already knowing Starbucks terminology because they sort of created their own thing. And now there's this new kind of coffee and you have to learn all that stuff over again because it's just a little bit different. Whenever people start talking about doing things better or the right way to do things, or, you know, just the idea that you can make something high quality, people sometimes think, well, I won't be able to do that, or it's too complicated.
Another big part of this book, Craft Coffee, a Manual, Brewing a Better Cup at Home, Jessica Easto in studio tonight, has to do with the history. I kind of mentioned the idea of the colonists at the beginning frying over fire coffee beans, like that was the way they would do it, and they would just put it into a cup and sweeten it whatever way possible. But there is a long history of America with the coffee bean, even though it's not really indigenous to this area.
Yeah, so I think probably, I mean, it's hard to tell because there's not a lot of recorded history, but coffee has probably been a part of colonial life since colonists came over, because it was introduced to Britain, I think, in like the 16th century. But it really started to gain traction after the Boston Tea Party.
That's right, because we threw the tea, say we don't want the tea, so we're going to go, let's try this other drink.
Right. And during that time, coffee was thought of, well, it still is, it's a commodity. It's traded just like wheat or corn or anything else. And the companies focused on cheap caffeine, and that was basically it. People usually, like at the beginning, they would boil their coffee with water, which resulted in burnt coffee.
right. The diner style that we kind of know. Right.
And, you know, it's interesting. I think doing the research for this book, I realized that a lot of these manual devices, that's sort of what I focus on in the book, is hand making coffee rather than using an electric coffee machine. A lot of these devices have been around for a really long time, but there are certain circumstances in the United States where they never really had to rise to prominence. So after people realized they didn't have to boil coffee, like percolators were really popular. Then the electric percolator was invented. And then soon after that, electricity sort of proliferated everything. And then drip coffee makers, electric drip coffee makers were like the thing that people used because it's the easiest.
And I'm, what I want to do, we'll take a break here, but when we come back, I want to talk about, you know, I only can talk about my own experience and I think, or my family's experience where, yeah, it was an electronic drip coffee machine. And frankly, it all tastes the same. I mean, you put it in, it doesn't matter if it's the bottom shelf brand or the top shelf brand, you put it in there and it comes out and the water and you're like, okay, it's hot and it's caffeine. And there hasn't been much of an adventurous palate on my end to try something different or to think that it could be better. And reading your book, I realized that there's a lot of opportunity to explore new ways to think about coffee that aren't necessarily going to A, break the bank, or B, take 2.5 hours to put together. Jessica Isto, my guest, Craft Coffee, a manual, brewing a better cup at home. We'll continue the conversation a Tuesday night industry night segment, talking coffee. Stay with us. Continuing with our Industry Night segment here on The Download, 720 WGN, I'm Justin Kaufman. Craft Coffee, a manual. Brewing a better cup at home. Jessica Isto is my guest. She's the author of the book that just came out. Okay, so we talked about the history, kind of got into it. We kind of skipped cream and sugar. That seems to be amazing how that was really just used. That was society giving up that coffee tastes good, right? That was
basically, yeah.
So we've covered that. That's good. All right, so let's talk about the brewing a better cup at home. You've charmed me, and I am done with my electric drip coffee machine. It's gone, right? Okay. It's thrown out the window. And I'm going to transition to a manual style. The first thing, and as people listening to this, this is important. This is right up there with the things you need to know, is that there's a spectrum. There's a coffee enthusiasm spectrum. And you need to know where you're at on that spectrum and make your decisions based on that.
Yeah, I think that's important because coffee shouldn't be hard or complicated, and you should do whatever you feel comfortable with. So in the book, I sort of give suggestions about, like, what is your budget? How much time do you want to invest? How complicated do you want your skill set to be? And there are options for all stages of the spectrum.
And that's important because a lot of people get intimidated when they go, I want to go and do something handmade or something a little bit more sophisticated. I guess I'll go to the high end. And then you find yourself spending 35 minutes, 40 minutes making a cup of coffee, and then you realize that this is not for you. It's in the book, and you can understand it, but the point being that you need to know where you're at.
Right.
Essentially, that's it. All right, so we're improving brew at home. Let's talk about the coffee bean. Right there. Why don't we start there? You talk about roast versus origin. You talk about it kind of plays with the third wave with what we were talking about. But why don't we start with the coffee bean?
So if I were going to give you advice for how to improve your coffee right now, I would say buy whole fresh beans from a craft roaster, so high quality beans. And one of the reasons why I recommend that is because third wave beans tend to be roasted differently than second wave, and it emphasizes origin.
So third wave would be independent shops in Chicago, coffee shops. Second wave, which you just mentioned, that would be the Starbucks, the Caribou Coffees, the Pete's, things like that.
Exactly. And craft coffee shops or third wave shops, they emphasize what we call origin character, and that's all the different flavors of the bean. Because beans, just like wine, can taste different depending on where they come from and what kind of variety.
And it's more sophisticated. You feel or you could taste that distinction when you're talking about the third wave.
Right. And second wave, there's a preference towards roast character, which is like the taste of the process, the taste of the heat, the taste of the carbonization. It's kind of like whiskey or bourbon, you're tasting the wood, the process of it being produced.
Right.
So with manual brewing, you have control over every part of it. And so you can tease out those nuances and those flavors from the lighter roasted beans.
Okay. So when we talk about teasing that flavor out, we're talking about improving. We need to talk about the grind.
Right.
So let's go there, because this is where this falls into the category of accuracy. Mm-hmm. And this is where I, even with the already pre-grinded processed stuff that I get from the Target or whatever. The only add that I add is I'm no longer doing it by teaspoons or tablespoons. I'm just kind of pouring it in there and going, all right, I'm going to put some water in and see if this works.
Yeah.
And I realized that reading the book that's where I need to get better.
Yeah, accuracy is important so you know what you need to do the next time to improve it. And if there's no record of exactly how much, you know, beans you use or exactly how much water, then you won't know how to change it. So back to grind size. So I recommend that you grind the whole beans fresh and you grind it to the right size for your device. So depending on what device you pick, it's optimized with a different grind size, and I have that all in the book. And that has to do with how long the water is in contact with the coffee, and that's what actually extracts the flavor from the coffee, is the water spending time going inside the beans and drying out the flavor. So the coarser the grind, the longer and harder it is for water to go into the coffee and take out the flavor, and the smaller the size, the easier it is. It's just like cooking any other thing. If you chop up your vegetables very small, they'll cook faster. The same concept applies to coffee. But the thing to remember about coffee is there's a lot of different flavor particles, and they all extract at different rates.
Right. And they extract at different times,
yeah,
when it comes to the actual process of making the cup of coffee.
Exactly. So if you want to talk about the two extremes of quote-unquote bad coffee, you often hear the term under-extracted or over-extracted. And all that means is, if the water doesn't spend enough time with the coffee, there'll be an over-concentration of the flavors that dissolve quicker, which tend to be very acidic or sour. And so you get that kind of nasty, sickly taste of under-extracted coffee.
It almost falls in that people a lot of times will mistake that for strong coffee or weak coffee, right? That's what they get that taste that, and I got this term from your mouth feel,
mm-hmm,
how it tastes in your mouth, but that doesn't necessarily mean how strong or how weak the coffee it is. It's just how developed the cup of coffee is.
Right. So, and it's interesting too. So like a sour note is associated with under-extracted coffee, and overly bitter or astringent flavors are associated with over-extracted coffee, or water that has spent too much time pulling out flavors. They tend to be bitter at the end and it overwhelms everything. But people often get acidity and bitterness confused. They're both not very pleasant. So it doesn't matter in the end. When you know that your water needs to spend more time with the coffee or it needs to spend less time, then it's easier to sort of get it where you like it to be.
Okay, so I'm just the stuff that I wrote down from the book, filters, the grinders, the scales, the kettles. I mean, there's a lot that goes into this. And, you know, I'm starting to sweat a little bit at my financial investment into this. Talk about, you know, what this all costs. I mean, for someone to go to the high end, to the third wave roaster, to be able to have this very specific kind of, you know, handmade coffee stuff, do you start getting into a sophisticated price range?
I think you can keep it inexpensive. And if you're not willing to invest, which I wouldn't be personally, if I didn't know I was going to use the equipment all the time, the thing I recommend is using a French press, because someone usually has that like in the back of their cabinet and they never use it.
I've got one.
Yeah.
Back of my cabinets.
And French presses are great because you don't need a fancy kettle, because it's basically just like steeping tea. And most people have a kettle already. So then all I recommend that you need is a nice grinder, which is a burr grinder, as opposed to a blade grinder, which is what most people have. A burr grinder.
Burr grinder?
Yeah, B-U-R-R.
Yeah.
It's just like how grains are ground at a mill. There's two metal plates, and they go farther apart or closer together for larger or smaller pieces, it's very even. But if you don't want to spend that much money, because they can be $100, $200, $300, you could get a hand crank model, and you can get that for like $20.
Okay, so that's what I'm doing. I'm getting a burr grinder. I'm going to go to the third wave craft roaster shop, right, to get the actual bean. I'm going to grind it. I'm going to use my French press.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I'm going to have to do, and this is a big part of when you talk about accuracy, is to experiment. I'm going to have to learn about how much is actually in there as opposed to how much the water is coming in, and each time be able to catalog either mentally or in some way, if I want to write it down, figure out a way to adjust as each day moves forward.
Right. I think one thing to keep in mind is coffee is highly variable, like depending on what kind you get and even what day you're using it, because coffee goes stale really quickly and it has a lot of volatile compounds in it, which changes. So you sort of have to, if you want to optimize your cup, you tweak it a little bit each time, or you don't if you don't want to. I mean, I use the specs that I have in my book, specs meaning specifications about like the time and how much to use and such. And if it tastes good enough, like you don't have to keep at it if you don't want to.
So you're forcing me right back to the Target?
Well,
you're telling me try it for a couple of days. If it doesn't work out, go back to your second wave.
Well, I think if you have the book and you use the instructions, you're going to be at the baseline. And then if you want to tweak it, or if you want to, like, say, make twice as much as you made the day before, then you might have to go back and forth a little bit. But the great thing is once you kind of understand how grind size affects coffee and how time affects coffee, it's pretty easy to make the best cup each day.
Jessica Isto is the author of Craft Coffee, A Manual, Brewing a Better Cup at Home. This is a great book, and I will check back in with you. I'm going to do this, and I'm going to check, have you back on the show, and I'll tell you what I learned in a couple of months. Jessica, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
All right, it's time to play the worst. It's 312-981-7200. It's the download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. This, of course, our weekly segment where we complain about the worst things in society for prizes. And we Yay. Got prizes. We've got, oh, yes, Lou Malnati's gift certificate. Of course, everybody loves the pizza. And we have the desktop indoor weather station back again. That was one from last week as well. That was a very popular item. There we go. 312-981-7200. Tell us your worst. We've got a great panel tonight. Claire Zuehlke is back. Good to see you, Claire.
Hey, Justin.
Claire, of course, a writer in Chicago and also the producer and creator of Funny Haha, which is next Friday, the 26th, at the Hideout, since you've got an awesome lineup.
Yes, sir. We have the gentleman sitting to my left, Hassan Ali, is going to be joining us. Jeremy Owens from You're Being Ridiculous. Kristen Toomey.
Toomey's
got a lot
great,
of great, yeah, great people coming to make people laugh.
There you go. Hassan Ali also in the house. First time. I can't believe that. Good to
Hi,
see you, buddy.
Justin.
How are you?
Good to see you.
You are a comedian, but you're also the editor of Slackjaw, the number one humor publication on Medium.
Yes.
And the Chicago one, of course.
I pay the bills by working at Onion Labs, which is the Onion's branded content division.
There you go.
Yes.
And you're going to be reading with Claire at Funny Haha.
And I will be doing that, too, as well. I can't wait.
His second time, which means he was so funny the first time that he's going to come back again and again.
That's how it works. That's how it works. All right. 312-981-7200. We got these great people in studio tonight. And, of course, we started off the way we start off every worst with Pete Zimmerman. He kicks it off. Pete, you ready to go?
You know what's the worst?
What's the worst, Pete?
When your Uber or Lyft driver calls you, when you're waiting for the ride, and then all of a sudden you see the 773
right
number
yeah,
come
right,
up,
right,
and you're
right.
like, no.
No.
Decline. I'm doing this because I want no interaction with
right,
anybody.
Right. I don't need that. Yeah. I know there's a lower and an upper Michigan. Figure it out. Sorry your GPS doesn't work. Sorry right. you made a switch. Sorry I got to get in the back of your car and you go, oh, they're trying a new GPS. I don't care. Anyway, yeah.
I
so
agree.
when you call the Uber driver or the Uber driver calls you. Yeah.
It's like
I want to call them back.
You order Instacart and they try to call you and try to give you substitutions. You're like, I'm just going to go to the store.
You know what? Yeah. This is already the social contract is
right.
off.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is not what I signed up
no,
for.
Bring on the robots.
I can't wait till the robots start calling us. Hello, Justin. I am at Dearborn. That's not even, what are you talking about? That's not even my neighborhood.
Do you have a Google Home or any of those
things? No, do you?
No, I'm petrified. of smart home devices.
My brother has one, and it's the best.
Oh, really?
It's so fun because it's so novel
yeah.
in the way that you're like, this is so cool.
Yeah.
But I'm petrified because I don't want something listening
yeah.
on everything that I do. There's a lot of singing by myself.
Yeah.
In the house, you know, yeah. I don't need that to be.
My parents got one, and I think it's kind of funny because they're like older people can be a little suspicious of technology, and they got Google Home because I think they just that's what they got. And the first thing I said is, "Hey Google, are you spying on me?" And didn't answer. Was didn't. Real suspicious.
Wow. The light just glowed and mm-hmm. pulsated.
Wow, that was early.
Yeah, it turned into
your
Roomba
first question,
and it slid
huh?
under the couch.
Oh, well.
It communicated with the Roomba.
Yeah. Just ran away.
That is the future. All right, let's kick it off. Claire, what do you got for the worst?
Kids' mittens.
Just did the worst.
Yeah. Finding them, pairing them, keeping them dry, keeping them clean, getting yeah. the right ones. Just over it. Just get new hands. I don't care.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm surprised at how they... my son has these little gloves. They're these little guys, you know, mm-hmm. and you're like, he's 10 years old and he's got these things. And I'm always like, these are not good enough. These are not, they're not going to protect you. You need those big, almost gladiator-like synthetic weird gloves
yeah.
that you
the
wear
ones that
at the
you can't
winter.
Feel anything.
Yeah.
And you
right.
have no
yeah.
dexterity. Well,
yeah.
Yeah. The gloves, not the mittens.
Our little one has like little fat baby hands, but he thinks, he sees his brother wearing gloves, so he wants to wear gloves. And it's trying to put fingers like articulated finger gloves on a big fat hand baby that doesn't know how to wear gloves is just a uniquely
that's
torturous
like,
experience.
Yeah, it's like lacing a boxer up.
Yeah.
You know, you're getting them ready.
But instead of a boxer, it's like a fish.
The clenched fist grinding of the teeth really felt that, Claire.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
the frustration over the kids' mittens. Okay, Hassan, what do you got for the worst?
Well, as part of my kind of New Year's resolutions, which I'm trying to stick to, is cooking more. And so the worst for me that I've realized is, you know, when a recipe calls for like this very exotic spice, right?
Right.
And I'm trying to adhere to this New Year's resolution of cooking and sticking to this recipe. So I go to Whole Foods and pay like $12 for this.
It's a good home chef.
Yeah, yeah. For a pretty exotic spice. Come home, put it in the recipe, and I could not tell if the spice made
I can't
a
taste
darn
the gold
difference.
Flakes. Right.
I can't taste the gold flakes or the unicorn tears. Yeah, like it has no discernible like impact on the taste of this recipe. I could have just put nothing in it, and then I have like $15 worth of this very exotic spice that I have to
yeah.
find recipes to use it up for.
I have the issue right now. And the download listeners are familiar with my continuing battles with my slow cooker.
Mm-hmm.
Like every time I'm like, I'm going to do it. I just made some turkey chili. And this time around, I was like, I am going to, man, I'm just going to pour a ton of stuff in there. I want to feel the kick. I want it to be, I want to overdo it. And I just tasted it right before I came on the show. And I'm like, again, it tastes like hot water and whatever was in the crock pot before.
Yeah.
Like it never tastes like you're supposed to taste. Like it doesn't taste like turkey chili. It's just, I don't know what
that's
I'm
weird,
doing wrong.
Because everything should
wrong.
Taste like turkey chili. Like that's what, like.
That's it.
The turkey chili should be setting the stage
how
for.
How do you mess that up?
Your future endeavors to taste like turkey chili.
I don't know. I just, I am, I. Every time it tastes the same, I'm like, is this, oh my God, is this the enchiladas or is this the turkey chili?
Maybe
I should clean the crock pot. Maybe that's where I'm making a mistake. That could
when,
be a mistake.
When they, the worst is like when there's no, when you have to, you need a substitution and people act like you're a jerk because they're like, oh, I don't have buttermilk. Well, why aren't you making your own in the first place? Like people will say, like, why don't you make your own yogurt and act like you, what have you been doing wrong this whole time?
The last segment was all about making your own, like coffee, like doing it the real way as
really?
Opposed to the Dunkin' Donuts on the on the bottom shelf at Target.
Oh, like yeah. I'm not supposed to use that Starbucks Via, like the pouch
yeah.
that it comes in to stir the coffee because that's what I do.
That's so second wave. Third wave here in the download. Hassan Ali, Claire Zolke playing the worst tonight. 312-981-7200. We got great texts already coming in. We'll read them when we come back. Stay with us.
It's going down, y'all.
Thanks, Rob. It is a download here, 720 WGN. Claire Zolke, Hassan Ali in studio playing the worst with me tonight. 312-981-7200. We got some good stuff already lined up on text. 708 starts us off with the cold weather. Worse is when it's 2 degrees outside and visitors are leaving our house. My wife inevitably stands at the front door with the door half open and talks to them while they saunter down the driveway to their car. By the time she's done, the house is an icebox. Mine's the other way around. I have a problem where just the way that I'm figuring out, because it's such a mild winter last year that I feel like, and my house is kind of new. I've only been in this place for like 2 years.
It's been a mild winter?
Last year was a mild winter. Oh, okay. Right? There was no snow or anything. Yeah. And I'm realizing this year that like I'm tracking in a ton of slop.
Right.
Yes.
There's a lot of slop everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And it does, and then you're like, wow, I did that?
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, geez.
And the mat doesn't really capture much.
No. We have a backup mat. We have like the boot racks and then the mat and the backup mat.
The backup mat is like behind the mat, so it's like another mat.
Yeah, it's like the
so it's just another carpet.
Mat. Yeah.
You've just carpeted your apartment.
It's like the mud room. Yeah, the first mat is the mat and the second mat is the mud room. All and right, then you're in the house.
Yeah.
All right, let's keep going here. 773 says, I annually do an art show in Bucktown. And I advertise on Facebook. My brother-in-law, who's very conservative, contacted me and asked if the fair had changed its name. I reviewed the ad and noticed I had a typo. Put an F instead of a B for the first letter of Bucktown. And I corrected it ASAP. That's hilarious.
I wish they kept it.
I want to go to that
Wouldn't
art show.
You? Yeah.
Come to the art show this weekend in Bucktown. That's good. All right. 847 says, the worst is when your restaurant is closing in 5 minutes for a holiday party. And a group of customers walk in and still insist on being seated. So I got to my work holiday party with 15 minutes left.
Oh, man. We should have said no.
Boundaries.
Yeah. I'm not sure. So the work part, the restaurant was closing. The holiday party was somewhere else. That's what I'm guessing.
Mm-hmm.
It made it seem like, can you not see all the employees? And they're like, John, you're going to take care of this. You have to cook it up. You're going to have to be the waiter, everything. We're all partying in this room.
Yeah.
773 says pretentious pour over coffee snobs the worst.
Ooh.
They're making fun of our 9:30 segment where I professed myself to I'm gonna dive in head first on the pretentious pour over coffee snobs.
You get a Chemex and all that
stuff. I'm gonna try it out.
Mm-hmm.
I felt dumb the first time I pour over coffee because I ordered it and I started to stand there and they're like it takes like 15 minutes to make it. I was like, okay, sorry.
Here's this kinfolk magazine to occupy yourself with.
I'm going to do it. And then, if it goes well, I'm going to make my own bread. So I've got a lot going on.
Wow.
2018's got a
lot.
If
you need any saffron, please.
I'll be over. Yeah, there
please,
you go.
Please, I have plenty.
All right. 773 says, when the worst is when you bid on a red Power Ranger action figure on eBay, and you win. But when you get it in the mail, it's a pink Ranger, which you already have.
Mm.
With a note that says, I'm sorry, my son broke the red one. Here's the pink one. I hope that's okay.
Not okay. But also, how much did that Power Ranger cost?
I don't know. That's probably, knowing from doing the swap meet with Greg Flam, I would say 30 cents, and he'll say, $150.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. I have no concept of what's valuable anymore.
We used to live near like a collectibles store, and we always told my son it was closed. Even fortunately, he doesn't know how to read yet, because I just really didn't want to go into a store with a bunch of former boys, like old stuff for sale. Like, I just didn't want to see your guys' old Star Wars toys. So, and then the store actually closed and went out of business, and I felt kind of bad because we sent a small store out of the neighborhood.
Yeah, you did.
I would rather the economy tank than we survive on someone's old action figures. I'm sorry.
Some of those Star Wars, man. Some of those 1977 Star Wars. Kenner. Is it Kenner, right, Pete? Kenner?
Yeah.
Yeah. That'll do it. You got yourself a Lando Calrissian from 1977 in the package. You're talking hundreds.
If you want to make guys mad, I learned this from a friend of mine. Ask if Ewoks are just baby Chewbaccas.
Wow.
No, they're not. No, yeah, right.
They could. They should be. They might as well be.
773 says, I have long blonde hair and wear a black wool coat. I was riding the L and it was crowded. I stood arm overhead holding onto the leather loop. I noticed people were looking at me. When I got to work, I hung up my coat and noticed I had a giant hairball under the arm of my coat.
Ooh.
Yeah.
As a cat owner, I can relate to that.
Yeah, right?
Does your cat have long blonde hair, especially?
Oh.
Like a long hair.
Like a Barbie.
Yeah. Yeah. Like a Barbie, yes.
All right, let's go to Ed. Ed and Joliet. How you doing, Ed?
Hi, Dustin. You know, the worst is pulled tab cans, especially vegetable cans. I never know which artery I'm going to cut. When I touch it with my finger, I can't open it, and I don't know what kind of utensil to use. And by the time I get done, I usually have half the vegetables in my lap.
Oh.
So that is the worst. Whenever I approach one, I always have to think, now what trouble am I going to get in?
Hey, I'm with you, man. Thanks, Ed. That was great. Good job.
All right.
He's right.
Yeah.
That's very relatable. Top
that yeah. And I always end up having to put my hand inside the can for some reason or other.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know how I can save
myself. I know, and that's supposed to be a technology, right? Or an improvement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The pull top is supposed to be an improvement on the no top, mm-hmm. right?
That's just asking for, like, Silicon Valley disruption.
Yeah.
Right there. Yeah.
Maybe we can get Google Home.
Get on it.
To
yes.
open the cans for us.
Yeah.
All right. Let's see. Here we go. 708 says, the worst is when after my wife stole my windshield snow scraper, I had to use my plastic library card to remove last night's snow. I didn't have gloves and I ruined the card.
Divorce.
Wow.
Oh, man. All right, there you go. 312's got a good one. I'm sitting on a bench this past summer, eating my bag lunch from the break at the Blackstone. I don't know what that, the hotel. I'm talking to this hot chick. This is, I'm not paraphrasing, this is what it says. And then I'm telling her I'm a big shot. And then there's a flutter in the air, we both look up, and I get hit in the nose with a glob of pigeon
stuff. Okay. Well, you know, that could be your time to shine. Like, is that, how are you gonna handle it? Are you gonna be funny and, like, you know, self effacing, or are you gonna panic? So it's sort of, that's a trial by fire situation.
Yeah, I'd panic.
That's a great meet cute story.
Mm-hmm.
He should have embraced it. You gotta embrace that.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, that's a double down moment. You're gonna show how much charm you have in the face of such adversity.
Right. Literally.
Hanging off your face.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. What are you gonna do? What did you do? You got to text back.
I need to hear some follow-up
information. Yeah, I want to know what you did.
And what happened to the lady? Because if she bailed, then no matter how hot she wasn't worth it.
Yeah. I mean, that's the old adage, right?
Right. We all know.
We all know
that song and dance.
If a bird poops on your nose and she leaves,
and she
wasn't worth it at all.
Right.
But if she goes.
But if she stays, then it was meant...
Meant to be.
Meant to be.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that... Yeah, right?
Not all adages have to rhyme.
They don't know.
312-981-7200. All right, let's keep going here. I got some more coming in. The worst is when it's 10 below zero outside and the gas pump asks you if you want a car wash. Really? There you go. Larry... is a Facebook friend of mine who is obsessed with winning this pizza.
Mm.
Like, he has gone after this. And I keep telling him, I'm like, you're putting too much pressure on it.
Because
he hasn't won it yet. And every week he says, I'm going to win it. This is it. Right away he'll message in saying, I got one for tonight.
Okay.
I'm really after that Malnati's pizza. And here's what he's got. You ready?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
779. This is Larry. Larry says, the worst is when the bathroom scale is off by 10 pounds.
Guess so.
I don't know. Zim's shaking his head no. He doesn't know if that was a good enough one. Right? I don't know. He might be right on that one.
I mean, what if it's up 10 pounds and, like, the bonus is that you were 10 pounds thinner than you thought you were?
You know what I have a problem with? I'm in the middle of kind of a diet, right? The problem I have is that the gym scale is the only scale I use.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're done working out at the gym, you go there, and that's like a good arbiter because that's the only thing you use. So you're losing weight by that thing. But then I go to the doctor, you know, and they do the weigh-in,
right?
And that is higher.
You know, you
like
can
by
request,
5 pounds.
You can request to not know. I used when I was pregnant with my second kid, I just refused to look, and I said, "Don't tell me."
No,
women know this.
I was upset because I'm like, wait a second. You know, like, you were just so excited about being at a certain number, and then this thing was five, and then, you know, you
Well, the doctor's one is wrong. The gym one is right, and the doctor is wrong.
That's what
and
I tried to tell them. That's why I spent the entire appointment telling them.
Yeah.
They're like, get off of it. And I'm like, no, I need to tell you. You need to change
my true weight is first thing in the morning after I've gone to the bathroom and I'm just, you know, as I came on this planet.
Yeah.
And that's the one true weight. And anything else is a total, you know, like been factored by all kinds of other
stuff.
That's
true weight.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, we all have true weight. All right, 312-981-7200, the phone number. We're playing The Worst tonight, where we complain about the worst things in society for prizes. Hassan Ali, Claire Zuehlke in studio. We'll take a quick break. We'll get an update from Rob on the news. We'll come back for the second half of The Worst. Stay with us.
It's going down, y'all. The worst come, my peoples come first.
When worst come, the worst come, my peoples. Joe Crow to rub some dirt on it. On the vertigo. Oh, that's the worst, man. Let's hope that that's, I hate to say I hope it's inaccurate, because that's not. He's right. I mean, Rob's right. There's Mark Lazarus is not wrong. He's going to be on our program. That's a bummer. Hopefully, find out more about that situation, Corey Crawford. We're playing The Worst tonight, 312-981-7200, apropos. Hassan Ali, Claire Zuehlke in studio. They're both going to be part of Funny Haha, the stage reading. Literary readings.
Yeah, it's Chicago's favorite literary humor reading series. And people read, they tell stories.
Is that a quote, or did you come up with that yourself? Is that a quote someone said?
You've only been
saying
it for...
Times.
Yeah, the New York Times. Yeah, the New York Times.
There you go. That's
nobody has stepped Chicago's to us favorite. And challenged us so far.
I always liked it when we would do Schadenfreude, we would say Chicago's favorite above-ground comedy group. Kind of play off the underground.
That's good.
Yeah.
No, I always say it's for if you want something funny, but you don't want to play a drink minimum at Zany's, yeah. You don't want to stay up late for a Second City show, you want to, you know, hear something, some funny stuff from people who don't always get behind the mic.
Yeah, it's great. It's one of the best shows in Chicago. It's at the really, Hideout.
It's a bargain.
Next Friday the 26th. Mm-hmm. Starts early, right?
6:30.
6:30.
And then ends at 8. So you can get out, go home, relieve your parents who are babysitters who might be standing by the door.
You're really selling it.
Yeah,
you're really selling it as a night out. Actually,
neat.
It's a big sale. It's a big
it
sale.
It is
right?
A selling yeah. point.
Hassan Ali will be part of that as well. He is the editor at Slackjaw, the humor publication on Medium, as well as working for Onion Labs. Both in studio tonight, we're playing The Worst. So let's keep it going. Let's go to Brian. Brian, what's the worst, bud?
The worst is actually being pulled over by an officer when you've only had one drink.
Oh.
Yeah, I guess you're right. That is worse, the worst. I don't know how to respond to that one, but yeah. Because technically, you shouldn't have any drinks,
right.
But you're under the legal limits, so technically you're okay.
Yeah.
But you're absolutely right. And I guess it would be not the worst if you're pulled over with four drinks. There's a lot to
there's
go in
nuance
there.
In that
there's
one.
Nuance, yeah.
Granted.
Exactly. Thanks, Brian. Oh, that's a good one. All right. Now let's keep going here. 312-981-7200. 84817 says Louis Anderson the worst. I do not agree. I'm a big Louis Anderson fan. Baskets.
Yeah,
Baskets. They must
yeah.
have just watched Baskets. I think it's coming back. It's one of my favorite shows.
I still have fond memories of the...
What if it's not the celebrity Louis Anderson? It's just like a personal friend of
yeah.
theirs.
Absolutely could be.
Yeah.
He's our text.
Yeah.
There's a lot of context.
Yeah.
Right. Tone. All right. Let's see here. When you lock your keys, this is 815. When you lock your keys in your vehicle... All right, not a good start to the story. It's running, wind chills below zero. The police tell you to call a tow company. You find a number for one that is open. It says text. And they finally text you back 40 minutes after you call, which is about 10 minutes after you broke out a window.
Oh.
That is pretty bad.
Yeah.
Ooh. 613 says chopped eggshell salad.
Yeah.
Those darn little pieces of eggshell that I can never get off, so I just leave them on. It's like egg stubble.
No.
Egg stubble.
I've never heard that. That's good.
Just
egg
buy
stubble.
Your egg salad.
Gross. That is good. All right. We keep going. Oh, that sucks about the window.
Yeah.
Break the window.
Yeah.
Do you put a cloth around it?
No, and then you're that car with the garbage bag.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
Yeah. Someone's got to be that car.
Deborah has a very specific one that I don't think many of us have experienced in our life. The worst is when you're on a packed red line train, sitting in the window seat, and someone with a trachea tube that has a big glob of mucus in it sits down next to you. Wow.
Yeah.
Huh.
I mean, that is a person who maybe deserves their own extra seat. They could have to pay.
That's what the big part of the car in the front is for.
Right.
You know, the luxury area.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, you get your own. That's where the trachea tube crowd. Right?
Yeah. Up in the front. Stand up for senior citizens expectant in the gross trachea tube.
In the trachea tube. 773 says, my dad was a second car in a parade for a political candidate. It was at the intersection of Lincoln, Damon, and Irving Park. The candidate was in the first car with a megaphone going down Lincoln Avenue. My dad took the fork in the intersection and ended up on Damon with the entire parade following him.
Oh, man.
That's great.
That is awesome.
That's a contender. That's hilarious.
Yeah.
If it's true. I feel like that's right out of, like, Animal House.
Yeah.
The microfiche archive.
Right. Right. And this day, well, that could have happened in the parade.
Is that in the Chicago Daily News?
Yeah. It's got to be somewhere.
The worst is when pets and children come into your bed during the night and you end up sleeping like a pretzel. What's even worse is when you don't realize they've left and you remain in that position longer than you needed to.
Oh.
That's a good one. That's very
like
good.
Having a ghost limb, basically.
Yeah. 773 says, people who put their windshield wipers up at night because of the snow, why don't you go ahead and eat your pizza with a knife and fork too, nerd? Wow. I didn't know that was the nerd category.
It is a little extra. Like, who do you think you're trying to beat?
What's the reason for doing that? Is it to, like, so they don't freeze?
I guess so.
Yeah, I'm
I guess
sure
when you're using your
sure.
wife's like, when you're using your library card to scrape the snow off, it's a little bit easier.
Us millennials, we don't understand.
No.
I don't understand. I don't understand the windshield wiper bit. I just have my computer. I have an app on a phone.
Yeah.
Someone's gonna.
It's my Uber driver's problem.
It's not yours, right?
Yeah.
All right. 708 says, listening to someone try and scrape the last little bit of liquid or food out of the cereal bowl is bad, but listening to one of your coworkers watch a YouTube video of someone scrape everything out of the cereal bowl is the worst. What?
Wow.
That's a thing? Everything's a thing these days. Everything's a thing.
Yeah. I'm curious.
That's a thing. You can go on YouTube and just watch people do that?
Yeah. Like, have you heard of ASMR?
No.
It's like... Yes, Claire knows what I'm talking about. You should check it. As someone who has like a very sensitive microphone in front of you, I think you would really appreciate it because it's like a sub-community of people who get like audio tingles from performers who like talk into a mic very softly and very delicately.
Come on.
Yeah, seriously, I'm not kidding.
Yeah, and they also do like little like have like brushes and like brush things against the mic.
And it's a YouTube thing?
It's... Yeah, it's like a cultural thing, yeah. But it's rampant, like subculture on YouTube.
Yeah.
Is it, does it turn them on?
It gives them, like, tingles.
Tingles,
like, you know, like, you know how when you get, like, you lose the blood flow to your foot and it kind of feels good weirdly when you put it down?
Yeah.
Like, it's like that kind of thing.
Yeah.
We should do the best on April Fool's Day. Can we do the best?
Yeah.
And it would be this. ASRM?
ASMR.
MR.
Okay.
Yeah.
630 says, the worst is when you have a shower that's so small that you actually have to open the door in order to bend down and pick up the soap.
Oh, man.
If you're staying in a hotel in Europe without actually getting the European... It's like staying in a hotel in Europe without getting the European vacation. Or so I've been told. Never been to Europe. That's great. All right. Having fun. Patty, what's the worst?
I think this is the worst for me and scary and costly. Oh. Remember that, I think it was December 5th, that humongous windstorm?
Yeah.
And I'm the last person out of a mall after 11 o'clock. So I'm the last person in this very, very dark, huge parking lot. And I just made it to my car, and the wind, and I'm alone, and the wind blew my glasses off.
Oh,
so now
gosh.
I'm half blind. I don't have any glasses. And I'm calling the police. Please try and help me. And the security guard, after the third call, comes out. He says, well, I think I can find your glasses. And about 40 minutes later, he never found them, so I'm half blind. I had to have my car towed. Next day, I had to get new glasses. And then they go to the lab, and when they made them, yeah. So it was very scary and very costly.
That was the worst. You're in a specific category.
Never heard of that.
Yeah. The wind blowing off your glasses and then having to get your car towed.
Yeah.
My car towed and new glasses next day.
New glasses.
Yeah. And new glasses are now are not no small thing.
Oh no, that was about $300 later.
That was my Warby Parker. All right, thanks, Patty. That is the worst. Thank you for that. That was a good one, right?
Yes. Can I give you one from this morning?
Yeah.
So I'm a good sleeper, and my husband is not. And the worst is when you have a good night's sleep, and then the person you're sleeping with starts complaining about how they had a bad night's sleep. And it feels like, first of all, you can't enjoy your own good night's sleep, and then you have to start sympathizing with them and also like brainstorming on how they can have a better night's sleep. And it just takes all the wind out of your sails.
Wind out of the sails. 949. We didn't read this one, did we? The worst is when you spend 4 hours on your weekend of your weekend to meal prep like a grown up. Then you forget your lunch at home, and when you get home, your roommate tells you he ate it. Oh, that's a winner.
All that brown
that's
rice.
That's so good.
Think about all that. I'm a dog, finally an adult, chopping onions and putting things together, and the roommate's like, oh, yeah, I ate it.
I thought that was for me.
Oh. Kind of roommate.
You know what's the inverse of that? As a and I feel like this is kind of a women be kind of thing, but like when you make dinner and you have leftovers and you give them to your spouse to take them to work for lunch, and he not only forgets them, he seems like he didn't really forget them.
You
he kind of purposefully
you take it personal?
Yeah. Because we would have been completist, you know, and you had a nice lunch of homemade food and you decided to go to Burger Baron instead. It's just not right. And, you know, if he actually forgot, but it's usually like a, oh, yeah, well, we were all going out. Anyway.
You know what's the worst for me is I'm big into the meals and bringing meals from home, especially here at night. And the worst is that what I'm not good at is cleaning the Tupperware.
Oh, yeah.
I'm terrible at it.
At work, there's no getting a good clean
There's not even running water down here.
Yeah.
And so you just stacks up. Yeah. And if I bring or I'll bring it home, I'll feel like I'm being responsible. I bring it home, and then because I'm not that responsible, I'll either leave it like where I walked in the door instead of bring it to the kitchen and cleaning it, or I'll bring it to the kitchen and then just leave it in the sink.
Yeah.
The next morning you wake up, you're like, what is this crusty thing? And I'm like, oh, I brought it home. What do you want?
Talk about things that always smell like the thing that was last in them, too. Yeah, like, once you make chili in that Tupperware, it's going to be red forever.
847 says the worst is misplacing your glasses in the morning and frantically looking for them for 20 minutes only to realize they're on your head.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Yes. All right. Just because it's 1048, I'll read this one. I don't usually like the raunchy stuff, but we're late. 312 says the worst is hearing your parents have sex.
That's,
you know what?
That is bad.
I say, be glad that your parents still love each other.
That is
true. Yeah, that's that could be a positive.
That is true. It's such a very specific thing.
Yeah.
There. Thanks for playing. 312-981-7200. We got Claire Zilke, Hassan Ali in studio. Two of the readers who will be on stage at Funny Haha next Friday. We'll take a quick break, our last one of the night, and then we'll come back and we'll have some room for some more. There's people on the line and some texts. We've got our, right now, we'll huddle up and see what we got for our favorites, but there's always a chance for someone to come in and steal. 312-981-7200. Stay with us. We're playing the worst tonight. 312-981-7200. We got our favorites, but there are a lot of people who want to steal. There are a lot of people on the line. There's also a ton of text, so let's get right to it. Let's go to Joe. Joe, what's the worst, Joe?
Justin, I'm going to tell you what the worst is. You get done shoveling all that heavy, slushy snow at the end of the driveway. You go inside. You're all warm and toasty, feeling smug. You're done for the night. 20 minutes later, you look out the window. And the big yellow plow just pushed a whole bunch all back in front of your driveway.
That sucks.
I don't know how technology has not fixed that.
Yeah.
I feel like that's something that we should get Silicon Valley on.
Yeah.
Like, figure out how to fix that problem that happens to everybody every winter.
First, they got the, you know, pop open can thing that we were talking about.
Right. Let's go ahead. Let's go out to San Jose or somewhere, not Silicon Valley. We're not ready for that.
No.
But somewhere near there.
Yeah, suburb.
Suburb there. And then we'll pitch these ideas.
Yeah.
We'll pitch all of them. All right, let's keep going. Karen, what's the worst, Karen?
Hi. Yeah. Hi. Today, I was parked on the side of the road. I went to get off and get back on the road, and I slid and went front into a ditch.
Oh.
Yeah. Well, then my grandson went to get something out of the trunk of the car, and the key broke off in the trunk, and we only have one key.
Oh, that's the worst. That's the worst. Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Now I got to have it towed. It's still out there. I have to have it towed tomorrow to the dealership. That's going to cost me a tow plus $80 to $100 to get a key.
I'm sorry. That's terrible.
Broken
Karen.
Keys are
Thank you,
the worst.
Karen. That's the worst. And I get it in the actual ranking of this game.
Yeah.
That is number one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure it's going to win, but it's
up there.
It's the worst. Karen, we feel for you. Mm-hmm. 224 says, the worst is when you finally get to sleep late and your husband accidentally rolls over in his sleep and bops you in the head with his hand at 4 in the morning, and now you're wide awake. There you go.
That is the worst, especially 4 in the morning is your sleep late.
Two separate beds, that's all I'm saying.
Mm.
You've been saying that all night.
I've been saying that.
All night. Yeah. Even we weren't even talking
proponent.
About it.
Big proponent.
Mary's got a great one. The worst is listening to the worst when somebody makes fun of the two things I do. One, pointing my windshield wipers to the sky, and two, eating everything with utensils instead of my hands.
Oh. Well... Yeah, well, you know what? Gotta, take some stock. Look at yourself.
224 says, I vote for Karen. It's not a vote, but you're right. Yeah, Karen, that's a bad situation. Karen might actually, we might figure something out. The worst is when you call a customer service call center like eBay and you have to give them all your personal information. When you ask for their name, they only give you their first name, John. Mm. Then I call back to follow up and they're like, we've got a ton of Johns. The worst 630 says, at a young age, buying a Mustang V8 before finding out that my insurance would cost.
Oh,
Jerry. Yeah, Jerry's. That's no good. No. You gotta check that stuff out first, right? All right, let's see here. We keep going. Frozen wiper braids. All right, yeah, we got that. All right,
Everyone's got opinions. We got the truthers.
Wiper blade truthers.
309 makes fun of something I said 4 hours ago. The worst is Starbucks baristas who won't like to make fancy drinks. I was that barista.
Oh.
And I won't go into a Starbucks or any other place now where if it's anything more than just a drip coffee, I can't put that on my brethren. I can't. Wow. So it's like a Frappuccino, no way. No way. Yeah. Even if I look at it, I'm like, oh, that looks good. I'd be like, nah, I remember making that.
Yeah.
I can't do it.
Even if it's at like a fancy intelligentsia place where they could draw your face on the top and foam.
Nope. I won't do it. Yeah. Oh, okay. It's 847. The worst is dropping somebody else's baby.
Wow. That's
good. There really Yikes. Isn't. Yeah,
that's true. That's there is like a certain luxury that comes with like dropping your own baby where you're like, well, at least it's my baby.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Someone else's.
Someone else's.
Oh, that is the worst.
That's the worst.
That's a good last minute one.
630 is the worst when someone pulls a clear plastic cap on the bottle of hot sauce and you pour a half ounce to your chili or soup.
Yeah.
815 says the worst is the day after your divorce is final, finding out that your ex just won millions in the lotto.
Wow.
That can't be real.
That's one from Ironic, Alanis Morissette.
Mm,
yeah.
It is.
That is one of the lines. Yeah.
From the cutting room floor.
847 says the worst is going to court and locking yourself out of your car without any of your documents and having the court officers having to unlock it.
No.
All right. There's a lot more here, but that's going to stop us right now. Thank you very much for playing, you guys. This is amazing. Hassan Ali and Claire Zolke. You can see them both at Funny Ha next Friday night for the best Chicago's best premiere.
Yeah.
Outstanding.
We have more things to say that are the worst if you come see us in person.
We'll literary reading series, humor series at the Hideout, 1354 Wabanzia, 6:30. Get done by 8.
It's going to be awesome. You need to laugh, Chicago, and you need to come to the Hideout if you haven't been there yet. And the proceeds benefits at Stay Read, which benefits at-risk kids in Chicago. Practice reading by reading aloud to dogs. It's legit, even though it sounds like I just made it up. So, good cause.
All right, I got 3 pizzas to give away, and I got desktop indoor weather stations as well. Lou Malnati's gift certificate. Lou Malnati's is home of Chicago's best deep dish pizza. Find one of their 40-plus Chicagoland locations or order online at loumalnati's.com. And the desktop indoor weather station brought to you by American Weathermakers, heating and cooling the 60-Minute Men. All right, why don't we start with the desktop indoor weather station. Let's give it to 773, who says, my dad was the second car in a parade for a political candidate. It was an intersection, Lincoln, Damon, and Irving Park. The candidate was in the first car with a megaphone going down Lincoln. My dad took a fork in the intersection, ended up on Damon with the entire parade following him. I hope that's real.
Yeah.
Well, it's real enough to get...
I believe it.
The weather station. We'll give him the weather station on that one. Also, let's do for the pizza, we'll do 773, people who put their windshield wipers up at night because of the snow. Why don't you go ahead and eat your pizza with a knife and fork, nerd? Yeah.
Controversial one.
Controversial?
Yeah.
And then we'll also give the pizza 949. The worst is when you spend 4 hours on your weekend to meal prep like a grown-up. Then you forget your lunch at home, and when you get home, your roommate tells you he ate it.
Now you got some pizza.
Yep.
Now you got Don't some let pizza. Your roommate eat it.
Right.
That's right. And you know what? If it's possible, Pete, the last pizza there, why don't we give it to Karen?
Yes.
You know what? I feel bad. Yeah. I should, the key breaking off, and Pete doesn't agree. He doesn't like it. But you know what? Karen will get the pizza. Thanks you guys for playing. It was great.
Thanks, Justin.
Thanks, Justin.